I know of cases, for instance, where Iranians made available Sabak agents to the press. They could interview them, who were trained in the United States in the International Police Academy. I even know of a case of one man who, when he was trained here, invented a torture instrument, which is a pretty frightening thing, because what it is, it's like a hair dryer, this old woman's hair dryers. And what they would do is they would put it over your head, over your ears, and they would torture you in your own screams. It was designed so it was acoustically such that your own screams would actually reverberate in your ears. And, of course, you might say, well, this man might have been planted. The Iranians are making propaganda. But at least someone should have gone and talked to them.
And checked it out.
And checked it out. Nobody did.
Hello, good evening, and welcome. This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On the 13th, Friday the 13th of December. It's lovely. I love the Friday the 13th. And we've got a special occultic Friday the 13th, a little bit of explanation about how the world really works. If you do understand that the Friday, any kind of Friday the 13th is a fantastic day. It's the day that the French king arrested all the Knights Templars back in 1307. And of course, this was a fantastic thing to do since they were like a stranglehold on the whole of Europe, the Templars. But anyway, we're streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol, one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. That is Bristol. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple or Not Aurora, though, or Google Play. Easiest place to get the app is just simply go to thisweek.org.uk. Scroll down past the big green button and you'll see a link there to download the app from for Android and for Apple. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda psyops, the heroic jihadis of Syria. Day-to-day, live, every day, on all over the mainstream press, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions and puff pieces on the conspirators, like whatever they're called, these Al-Sham people, and the CIA and CENTCOM, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, twisted Armageddonist, accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. And we'll be giving a little bit of time to accelerationism tonight, actually, in the run-up to Christmas. Good to understand these bigger picture things, of course. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment puppets, the cowards and control freaks, see us as slaves to their AI agenda. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King, we can't forget to mention him, Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla, wage war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS through their panandaride energy saboteur secretary who's been... I won't be rude about him saying something today, Ed Miliband. But it's not the end of the world. Of course it isn't. Or is it? Helping us navigate the accelerationist World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week we'll be looking again. Martin will be absolutely rolling around with glee. We'll be looking at the farmers again because, of course, they took over Whitehall with 600 plus tractors on Wednesday. Plus, in part two, we'll be taking a real good look at what's been going on over in what used to be called Syria. I suppose it might be just called Israel in future. Who knows? So, Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel, and then by Ofcom, who's also fined Royal Mail, much to the delight of all these rubbishy people that try and deliver stuff and then just sort of chuck it over the fence. So that's great. Well done, Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from the PRSC by the trans lobby, but not cancelled here yet. So, Martin, we've got to start, obviously, with... the momentous events. So I don't think either you or I were really expecting we'd see Assad fly out, will we, last weekend, and at the end of the Syrian government?
No, it was very quick when it came, and I think it's taken quite a lot of people by surprise, but I presume some people, like in the Turkish intelligence services, probably knew an awful lot more about it than we did.
So what's going on? I mean, the obvious thing is we're in this very interesting interregnum right now between Biden and Trump. So the deal's being done. I mean, this is seems to be the obvious thing.
Well, the timing is obviously, you know, crucial, because the ceasefire, so-called ceasefire in Lebanon, then, you know, then this sudden attack.
So it's about that. It's not
well,
about
no, it's,
to
it's,
do
it, with... timing. I said timing is crucial, but it's also to do with the transition of power in the US. So the people in charge now want to get various rabbits running before Trump gets anywhere near the steering wheel of the car.
Like what?
Well, I mean, the various things that are happening is clearly the US deep state, not just in Syria, but in Georgia, possibly in South Korea and elsewhere. They're upping the ante now to make sure that whatever Trump thinks he might do or not do, a lot of things will already be fait accompli.
So the Al Shamlot, they were proscribed. There was a little bit of a dispute about where this absolutely fascinating. These sorts of things to me, the US on their terror watch list. They're definitely there. The group that's now taken over Syria, the main group, certainly Damascus and the south of the country. On the British list, it says Al Qaeda and in brackets and some affiliates. And many people are saying, well, they actually are on the list because they're an affiliate. And other people saying, well, you haven't named them, so they're not proscribed in Britain. Now, this suggests to me that the Brits are actually trying to keep that deliberately vague in case they want to, decide to prosecute or not to prosecute someone from this group or supporting this group.
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it, which groups are proscribed and which groups aren't, and what possible criteria could be used to choose. I think it's undoubtedly the case that they're proscribed by the US, and they've got a $10 million reward out for him. All of this underlines that in actual fact, Al-Qaeda, so-called, has always been a heavily manipulated tool of Western intelligence services, going back to the creation of Al-Qaeda in the 1980s. It wasn't some kind of spontaneous creation, group. It was created quite deliberately by the Safari group of Western intelligence services, coordinated by the French, and then also, the British got the lead role in it, in Operation Cyclone, to create Islamic International Brigade, and they were all trained by our own special forces. Undoubtedly, these guys have been trained by NATO special forces. They had Ukrainians flying drones for them. They had tanks. You know, most guerrilla forces don't know how to use tanks. They knew how to use tanks because no doubt the Turks, who are our allies, they're part of NATO, showed them how to use them. So, I mean, underlying all of this is the rank hypocrisy of the whole thing. We're supposed to have had a great war on terror for over two decades, and the main enemy of that is Al Qaeda, which turns out to be one of our lots anyway.
Okay, so Hayat Tahrir Al Sham, are they a sham?
Well, they're not entirely a sham. I mean, obviously, you've got, there was discontent in Syria, which they have exploited. But quite a lot of their fighters, for example, are not from Syria at all. Many of them are from Central Asia, Turkmen, and also from, from the Uyghurs, from the East Turkestan.
When I use the word sham, I mean in the usual words. So, for example, the idea is this is some sort of independent force that's on its own, maybe with a bit of covert help from somebody else, but certainly not us, has taken over Syria. Surely it's not. It's not a front organisation. So it is a sham.
Well, it is, and the point is that for this to work for the Western intelligence services, they've got to have a degree of deniability.
Their deniability is that the mainstream press just doesn't question any kind of connection to the West, as you've been talking about just now.
Well, it's quite odd, because obviously this guy's, previous pictures of him, he's got his head covered, big beard, he looks exactly like a jihadi should look like. But of course, one of the things they've done, they've made him look like Zelensky. So he's got exactly the same sort of beard as Zelensky, a bit longer because he's Muslim, obviously, and he's got the same kit on as Zelensky.
Looking at their logo, it looks surprisingly like ISIS. It's just a different colour. It's a kind of greyy, bluey colour rather than black.
Well, I mean, they've had top PR people saying, how do you rebrand, That's why Windscale is now called Sellafield. This is Al-Qaeda and it's now called... whatever it's called. But it's just, you know, it's basically the people in it are people who were in Al-Qaeda and in ISIS. He was in ISIS as well. He wasn't just in Al-Qaeda. But now he's a reformed character, Tony. So we're told.
Yeah, really. Okay, anyway, so I'm going to we're going to have a listen now to Susan Lindauer, who I spoke to yesterday. She's we were chatting about her. I said to her when I called her during the week, I said, were your ears burning last Friday? Because we were talking about you. And she had quite a big involvement, Martin, didn't she, with the... in fact, she let's let her introduce herself and explain what she had to do with the early, well, I suppose we'd call it the early days, 2011, 2012, and also, of course, the overthrow of Gaddafi.
My name is Susan Lindauer. I am a former CIA and defense intelligence asset. I worked in anti-terrorism covering Iraq, Libya, Syria, Lebanon in the 1990s. I negotiated the Lockerbie trial with the Libyan ambassador, and I negotiated the return of the weapons inspectors to Baghdad with Iraq's ambassador. I came out, I was one of the very few voices against the Iraq war, shouting from the rooftops against the groupthink that was driving the United States to war. I was then arrested on the Patriot Act, thrown in prison for a year, held under indictment for 5 years. Though there was a categorically, I never spied for the Iraqis. I never received monies from the Iraqis. But the fact of my opposition and the knowledge that I possessed, because I was directly involved in all these issues, was so scary to the elite that they kept me under wraps. And so I actually have a very unique position, especially with regards to Syria and Lebanon. Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar Assad, once put a contract out on my life through his government did, through Manzer al-Qassar. Ahmed Jibril and Abu Nidal put a contract out on me with Manzer al-Qassar, who was later arrested and extradited to the United States. He did 20 years in prison, and while I was under indictment, he was put in the courtroom right next to mine. So he was assigned to the courtroom next to mine for trying to kill me while the United States government was denying that I was a CIA asset. And so it was very this is actually very important, because the chaos that these people create and the degree of dishonesty, I hope and pray for the sake of the Syrian people that they're going to be okay through this. I have a my brother's ex-wife is a Syrian refugee, dissident, who hated the government of Bashar al-Assad, and I am myself anti-war, deeply anti-war, lifelong anti-war, anti-violence. So I have a very complex opinion of what's happening in Syria. I have always opposed U.S. military intervention in Syria. I have, I am very deeply aware of Syria's relationship with Iran and its client state status, or that Lebanon was a client state of Syria during the civil war of Lebanon. There's just, this is a lot more complicated than I am very suspicious whenever someone, the elite media, the corporate media, give me a pat answer telling me that they've accomplished something really great and that everything's going to be okay now. Oh, no.
She's right, isn't she? It's not going to be okay. I mean, it does look extraordinary that the Russians should sort of walk away from this, Martin. The obvious question is, Trump, as we know, is negotiating to try and end the war in Ukraine. He's saying he's going to do it in the first 24 hours in January when he's inaugurated, if he's inaugurated. And so is this not just a potential quid pro quo for that? He's saying to the Russians, look, just get out of the Middle East. You've got no business there. You're just going to get harangued and hammered. there's obviously loads of trouble brewing between Israel and the jihadis. You probably best just get out the way. Maybe the Russians have just gone, well, actually, you know, we are kind of only half in and half out there with the air force. We don't have boots on the ground or anything like that. So maybe you're right. Maybe we should just get out while we can. And we're very thankful that you're now campaigning to stop the Ukraine war, because we're much more concerned about that.
I doubt whether there's that level of sophistication in the communications between the Russian side.
Well, that was a long-winded way of saying Trump is saying to Putin, look, get out of Syria and we'll make sure that the Ukraine war finishes. That's a very simple line, isn't it?
It is, but I don't think they've had that conversation, Tony. I think there is very tense...
No back channels?
No. There has been... What the Russians have been saying is that they've had no contact directly with Putin, with Trump at all so far.
Well, that's just...
That doesn't,
mean that
deals might not be being made behind the scenes, but I suggest to you that it's way too speculative to imagine that there's some very complex deal going on here.
That isn't complex, is it? You get out of Syria and Ukraine war is finished.
No, because the Russians don't want to end the Ukraine war because they're winning. The issue for them is how can they sustain the war to the end to victory.
Their people are dying. They want to end it. They want a peace. Of course they do.
No, Trump came out with this yesterday or today, saying that loads and loads of Russians died in the recent fighting, and of course they'll really be looking for a solution. They're not looking for a solution because they're going to win. They are not going to give up the four oblasts that they claimed at the beginning of the war.
No one's saying that.
And the general staff in Russia wants to claim
Odessa. You're making all sorts of assumptions, jumping into those assumptions. I mean, we could be talking about a peace in Ukraine, which is just draw the line where it is now and let's forget it.
The Russians won't accept that kind of peace, and they're not going to go for it. So the idea that they're negotiating with Trump to get a deal they don't want, and they're going to give up Syria on the... I think in actual fact what's happened here is everybody's been blindsided. I don't think that the British and the Americans and the Turks that are behind this group expected them to take Damascus. They thought they were going to stop in Homs, and then there would be some kind of quid pro quo. And of course that's not what's happened. And I suppose that's what happens if the Syrian army is going to fade away. It just fades away. And they've had all of their equipment smashed in the last week. 80% of everything.
Nothing to do with the deal that was done, is it?
No, but there might not. You're saying there was a deal. I'm saying that there isn't a deal.
I think there was.
All right, think there was. I don't think there is.
It's very easy for people like you and I who get blindsided by this. Like last week, yes, okay, they're taking over these cities in the north, but then to see Damascus fall is a big surprise. Well, my explanation for that is not that, oh, well, that was just an amazing thing that happened. My answer for that is no, deals have been being done behind the scenes. And one of the people involved in those sorts of deals is likely to be that little chappy from NATO who seems to have one foot inside NATO and one foot outside NATO, who's name is President Erdogan of Turkey. And we had Douglas McGregor on the Judge Neapolitano show earlier this week talking about that, amongst other things. Very interesting take, I think, McGregor's got.
I don't think this looks good under the Trump administration, given the folks with whom he has announced he plans to surround himself, who will ally themselves to the wishes of the American deep state and military establishment. Switching gears, Colonel, what role did the United States play, if any, in toppling President Assad of Syria?
I think we have to take credit for having played a very major role. We have had people on the ground working to remove Assad since 2011. And we could go through this timeline, but the point to keep in mind is that we've done everything we could to support his removal, because that, of course, was the wish of the Israeli government. They were always anxious to remove Assad and would do anything at all possible to remove him. Keep in mind, right now in Egypt and in Jordan, the other two Arab states that border Israel, other than Lebanon, we have what are effectively regarded in the Arab world as puppet governments that are essentially loyal to us. We buy them. In fact, this morning I discovered that a $900 million check from the U.S. Treasury just arrived this morning in Jordan. The Jordanian government will obviously be very grateful for that. We have been renegotiating the debt that Egypt has. In other words, we have bribed people in those places. We bribe people all over the world, but specifically in those places to keep them on side when it comes to Israel. Now, the Jordanians are in a tough spot because the Israelis can shut off their water supply. They're not anxious to end up like Gaza at this point. Egypt's a little different now, and the Egyptian population there is very angry. We should come back to that because what happens in Egypt is very important, and you could see something similar to what has happened in Syria happen in Egypt.
Here is the president of Syria, President Assad, before he was deposed. This is in 2017, saying very similar to what you said, that the United States does not want partners, it only wants puppets. The key part to what he says, this is about 60 seconds long, the key part to what he says, with which I suspect you'll agree, is at the very end. Chris, number 13.
The problem in the United States is about the whole political system. It's not about one person. Trump's election has proven again for us, again and again, that the president is only a performer. He's not the decision maker. He's part of different lobbies and the deep state, or the deep regime, as we can call it, who implement and dictate on the president what should he be doing. And the proof to what I'm saying, that Trump, after he became president, he swallowed most of the promises and the word that he was boosting during his campaign. He made 180 turn in nearly every promise. So why? Because the deep state wouldn't allow him to go in certain direction. That's why, for me, dealing with him as a person, it could be, but can that person deliver? No. And the United States president cannot deliver. The whole state, the deep state only, is the one who can deliver. And this is the problem. This deep state doesn't accept partners around the world. They only accept puppets. They only accept followers. They only accept proxies. That's what they accept. We're not any of these.
He's gone, of course, but I think he had a good handle on the influence of the deep state in foreign affairs, don't you?
Well, he's repeating essentially what President Putin has said and others have said over the years. And in his case, he tried to evade becoming a puppet or being removed through the arrangements that the Russians, Iranians, and Turks made in Sochi and Astana. And these were agreements that were designed to essentially freeze the ceasefire after ISIS and its offspring and affiliates, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and so forth, had been defeated back in the teens. He thought this would last. Obviously, it didn't. It was never a perfect outcome because there was a Kurdish state emerging in the northeast of Syria, and the Turks had moved into and occupied a portion of northern Syria and then created, under Erdogan, this enclave of radical Islamists, essentially the survivors of ISIS, and nurtured them over the years and prepared them for what they're doing now. We've also done the same thing in the enclave that we control over on the border with Iraq. We've repurposed many of the same people, roughly 11,000 of them. And about 17,000-18,000 more were under Erdogan. And of course, Mossad was involved with the CIA and MI6 in the equipping and training. But the principal job of coaching the Islamists collectively in how to do it and where to go and what to do is really President Erdogan.
It's just another aspect which really hasn't been looked at much at all, is it? In northern Syria, Erdogan's a massive player and always has been. This is land the Brits took off of the Ottoman Empire in 1917 and 1918. Allenby, the Balfour Declaration, when he took the south of Palestine, and when he took the north of Palestine, it was the end of the First World War. The Turks have been eyeing this land up, haven't they, Martin, for decades, a century, and saying, actually, that's ours, and we're having it back.
Well, there is an element of that, but of course the problem is that they don't speak Turkish in Syria, they're Arab. And if you remember
Well, isn't it about the resources, really, rather than just the language?
Well, of course, but the thing is you've got to have a story that you're telling about freedom, you know, never mind the resources. So, of course, when the British took it over, the whole thing is that we had an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. So the Arabian parts of the empire were then supposedly going to be given independence by Britain and France. But, of course, they weren't. They were carved up by the British and the French. And, of course, the Israelis ultimately got Palestine. The Turks are major, because of the geography, they are major kind of swing state in international affairs.
Well, they're not swinging, though, are they? They're keeping a foot in both pies, knowing also...
That's right.
They're keeping
a foot in both camps. Exactly what they do.
Not in both pies yet, in both sides of the fence, dangling on top of the fence there, sitting very, very much on it completely. But the point is, the Turks are making a lot of money, aren't they, by running through the Russian sanctions and that sort of thing.
They are. But they've been quite happy to break the sanctions on Russia because, you know, the people who break the sanctions can make money at the expense of those fools in the European
Unions
who are driving their economies
If the Europeans and Americans really wanted to cause trouble for the Turks, they could be sanctioning Turkey and the Turkish companies that are simply buying goods from the West and then selling them on to the Russians. They could easily do that, but they choose not to.
Yeah, what they're also doing is selling Russian oil onto the European Union.
It goes all sorts of directions.
Because it's not Russian,
maybe they should have a nice little Nord Stream pipeline through Turkey.
Well, this is about pipelines. If Syria was stabilised, you could have a pipeline from Qatar through to Gaza, and you can also if they can conquer the region, there's all sorts of things that they're after. But I think the Turks are very important in all of this, but then there's the fly in the ointment is the Kurds, because the Kurds are still there, PKK aligned YPG people are still there, they're armed, they do know how to fight. The Americans have been fighting, helping them along, and we've had our guys in there with them as well.
McGregor was saying that. It's nice to hear him mention MI6. They sometimes get forgotten.
They do, because
they seem to be one of the main agencies.
People in this country seem to be under the delusion that we have a secret service, but it doesn't do anything very much, and apart from the fact that they're now coming on the TV and telling us all the things they do and to be very, very afraid of various things. We've got to be very, very afraid of the Russians.
Yeah.
We can't tell you why, because it's hush, hush.
Dear love, saying,
but,
actually,
really,
this is...
Really, well, really, you've got to be love, very, very afraid of them.
Dear love from MI6.
But we can't tell you how we know these things.
Oh, well, actually, we can't tell you why or how, but it is already World War III.
Well, that's right. I mean, in other words, in the past, these people were very much in the shadows. You didn't even know who they were. Now, not only do we know who they are, they come on and try and persuade us of various things. Unlike conventional politicians, they can just say, well, we don't know, we can't tell you how we know this. But listen up, children.
But that's exactly what those BBC, all of the London newspaper and TV company security correspondents say exactly the same, don't they? Sources
right.
tell us. They're actually exactly the same. And in fact, was it Charles Shoebridge on this programme that told us a good few years ago, the former special branch and army officer who did lots of commentary on until he sort of disappeared. He got another job to sort of get him out of the way, I think, off the airwaves. But he said that these correspondents, the security correspondents of all the major newspapers, TV, radio in Britain, are really just the PR people for MI5. And MI6.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you want to be the defence correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, you need to know all these honchos inside the secret.
And we know our sham are really annoying and very difficult, but we think we need to give them a chance on this occasion. I think that they may have just, be a really nice bunch of guys. So let's just give them a go. And they're not head choppers. Well, they were head choppers, but maybe not anymore.
Well, I think for the Syrian people, it's an intake of breath moment, because obviously some people have been celebrating in Damascus today. Some people were very happy to see the regime go, others less so. I've seen videos that are already circulating in Latakia, which is the heartland of Assad's family and of the Alawite sect to which he belongs, and they're carrying out summary executions of people they regard to be traitors. Now, if you're one of those people that might be regarded as a traitor, maybe you're not so keen on what's happened. Civil wars are very rarely sweetness and light. And, of course, reprisals against people that the new regime doesn't like is quite likely. But, of course, they're saying that they want to try and negotiate. Now, what I understand is happening is that people are trying to negotiate with them. So the Kurds are trying to negotiate with them, although there's already been clashes between their people and the Kurds.
Well, shouldn't they maybe just be contacting CENTCOM and ask them, can you give us a number for this guy?
Well, no, they've also been talking to the Russians. They've also Hezbollah have also said, well, we're open to discussions with them. because the reality is that they are now, you know, in control. Of course, we can't. They were asked on Channel 4 this week, have you got anything to say, one of their spokespeople, about all the Israelis coming in and taking over the whole of the south of the country? And they said, we've got no comment to make about that. Now, this is very suspicious, because you'd have expected... I mean, it's not that suspicious. Al-Qaeda has never attacked Israel, ever. So it's not that suspicious.
It doesn't mean to say they're not going to at some point, does it? The idea, surely, in Syria is to build up loads of these and then to go across the border into Israel and have a real proper
fight. Well, that's why the Israelis have been blowing up all the advanced equipment of the Syrian Arab Army, which, of course, should, in fact, pass to the new democratic government when they've had their election. But of course they won't be able to, all of the kit which used to keep the Syrian army used to have to keep the Israelis in check, a lot of it, you know, high-tech stuff relatively speaking, is all smashed to pieces.
Yeah, and they're not going, the Israelis. They've gone in there to destroy all this stuff.
I think they have. I mean, they've taken over Mount Hermon now, which is overlooking Damascus. They used to have half of it. They've taken all of it, and they're not going to give that up.
The idea is surely all these jihadis are now gathering in Syria ready to attack Israel, and they're keeping their powder dry. They're not saying we're going to attack Israel, they're just going to gather
everybody
there.
Some of them have already, you know, there's some videos on saying now on to Jerusalem.
And
of course, other spokespeople are saying, oh no, we like the Israelis, we want peace with them.
Isn't this sort of justice of some sort after what the Israelis have been doing in Gaza? A lot of people around the world are crying out, will somebody please give the Israelis a bloody nose and tell them to stop killing innocent women and children? Tens of thousands, something like 50,000 that they've done now in Gaza.
Well, it's a lot more than that if you think about it, the knock-on killing.
So isn't there an element of justice which may bring radical Muslims from around the world to join the fight in Syria to take down Israel?
Well, interestingly enough, Hamas's spokespeople have said that they welcome the change in Syria and they hope that the new government will continue to support Palestine. Because Hamas and these people were relatively... I mean, Hamas actually joined in on their side during the beginnings of the conflict in Syria, which greatly annoyed Assad, because, of course, he'd been very helpful to them over many years.
And yes, well, they were rubbing their hands in Langley, Virginia.
Yeah, well, you know what's going on here, Tony, is divide and rule, which the British were experts at for many, many centuries, and we're still, you know, the Western intelligence services are still doing exactly that.
Play
one against the other, and we end up controlling everything.
For me,
this is how we controlled India.
You and I are minnows compared to some of the really great commentators on this, people like Vanessa Beely and Richard Medhurst. And we're going to hear now from Richard Medhurst. He was one of the journalists who was arrested earlier this year, or detained at the airport as he was flying into the country. So disgusting, by our Gestapo police, and Matt Dukes, the guy that's handed loads of evidence of police corruption and then just chucks it in the bin. It doesn't bother. And that's the man who's now in charge of the anti-terror branch of the Met Police and likes to arrest or detain journalists or take their contacts and maybe then stick them on a computer system or just hand them straight to the Israelis. God knows what he does with them. I certainly don't think most people would be prepared to hand contacts like that to the Metropolitan Police or any other police in case they found their way into the Israelis and your contacts get then murdered, assassinated over in Israel, as they've been doing to so many other journalists. But let's have a listen to Richard Medhurst, his take on this surprise announcement of the departure of Assad and the end of Syria this last weekend.
The people cheering this on are mental. You've taken away a bad car and then given people a bicycle instead and called it a set of wheels. I mean, this is a downgrade, to put it mildly, in every way. Syria was secular. Syria was safe for all religions and ethnic groups. Syria, remember, is a Christian country first. Christianity was born in Syria. Syria is just as much Christian as it is Muslim. But now Christians and other minorities are under threat. The first photo that they post of this new cabinet and this new prime minister, this is a state institution, right? They've got an Islamic extremist flag right next to the Syrian flag, the new Syrian flag. What kind of message is that supposed to send to Syrian Christians who make up 10% of the population and other minorities? It tells them, basically, screw you. You're excluded. That's what it means. And we see the extremism on the streets. We see the ISIS trucks driving through Christian neighborhoods in downtown Damascus, firing Kalashnikovs into the air and terrorizing people. A Christian journalist who was stopped in a Christian neighborhood and questioned about her religion I mean, this is unheard of in Syria. You've got priests that are hiding their crosses when they take photos with these new leaders. And then we're supposed to look at that and believe that this is inclusive. This climate of fear did not exist a week ago, all right? Syria is going backwards. Syria was self-sufficient in oil, gas, wheat, cotton, grain. Syria had no foreign debt. Its central bank, its monetary policy were independent. They were not controlled by the West. Syria had free healthcare, free education, social welfare programs, social safety nets, improved literacy rate, improved infrastructure. I saw all of that with my own eyes. And now what is happening? It has regressed. But as soon as this new regime in Damascus announced that Syria will be a free market economy, meaning come in, bring your foreign direct investment so you can control our monetary policy and our politics, what happens? The United States removes Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, meaning Al-Qaeda, from the terrorist list. Isn't that amazing?
So, bless you, man. Richard Medhurst there with his, as usual, excellent commentary on what's going on in the big wide world. But particularly there, as he says, Martin, he was baptized there. When he talks about this whole thing of Christianity being born over in Syria, he's referring there to Acts chapter 9. And this is Saul on the road to Damascus being converted. At least I think that's what he's referring to. Becoming this chap Paul, who was one of the great founders of the Christian church, on the way to Damascus. Now, for those that don't know, that Saul, before he got converted, was one of the biggest persecutors of the Christians, a very effective one. And he completely changed his tune and became extremely pro-Christian, as he had this kind of supernatural experience on the road to Damascus. So Damascus, very important, isn't it? But what do you make of what Richard's saying there, Martin, about the plurality, the economics of Syria, and how that's all going to go now?
Well, he's quite right that the Syrian government had a neoliberal policy, but it was still a family firm. Let's put it that way. No debt
and that sort of thing. So no, it was Libya, wasn't it?
I'm just talking about how it actually worked. All of the economic stuff
works,
is right.
Does it? I mean, if they're fighting the IMF, surely they're doing a good thing.
Yes, but at the same time, Hafiz al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad were a family dynasty. And of course that can, and I think a lot of the I've been reading a lot about this. Most people in Syria wanted a secular state, but they didn't necessarily want that. The Syrian army haven't been paid for months.
Sounds to me like they've got a better welfare system.
They did have a better welfare system, but of course what's happened, if we smashed all that up, basically what's happened since all of this began is that Syria has gone from being a relatively successful, prosperous place and one of the most relaxed places to go in the whole of the Middle East, although of course lots of people were still in prison who opposed the regime. It wasn't the sort of place where people, you know, spoke freely. But nevertheless, it was a much better place than it is now. And what we have done with our taxes and our special forces is turned it into a wasteland. And that's the great achievement. Because, of course, the real problem for the West is successful, non-capitalist development paths. So they've got to smash that. Otherwise, it's a bad example. And everybody will want what they've got. Free healthcare. You know, Syria, which is a developing country, had free healthcare, including all modern facilities. Many people in the United States, the capitalist leader, they don't get free healthcare. And of course, if Syria can provide free healthcare, then everybody can do it. That's why we've got to get rid of free healthcare in Syria, and that's what we've done.
So we've given birth to this jihadist state now, haven't we? With all these other faiths, religions, etc., being persecuted. I've not seen anything about that on the mainstream press.
No, the mainstream press have been told what to say, which is, this is all wonderful. As Keir Starmer said, it's great that the barbaric Assad regime has fallen. But of course, what they said, I mean, you know, what was it to Boris Johnson said about Libya? Once they've cleared the bodies away, it's going to be the most successful place in the Mediterranean. Well, I'm afraid it isn't. It's basically a failed state, which is the source of most immigration into the European Union, and that's the result of our intervention.
Libya is, a complete basket case. I spoke to Susan Lindair in the longer interview, which will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, about Libya and many other things. So it's almost an hour long altogether, that interview. She has such an insight into this because of her role as a CIA asset in the run-up to the Iraq War and also the overthrowing of Gaddafi. She was one of the chief negotiators to get the trial of Megrahi for the Lockerbie bombing, even though she didn't necessarily, well, she didn't afterwards. She said, I didn't believe that the Libyans were even involved in the Lockerbie bombing. And as we said last week, a lot of the evidence points to there being a DIA, I think, isn't it?
DEA,
Drug Enforcement Agency team on the Pan Am Flight 103 heading back to the United States with evidence that the CIA and other elements of the US military covertly were out there in Lebanon and other places, Bekaa Valley, I think she said, doing loads of dealing in heroin and using the money that they raised to finance some of these jihadis, Martin, in various
right.
parts
well,
of the world.
That's exactly how the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda were funded in Pakistan in the 1980s. So there's loads of money chucked at it, like taxpayer money, but of course, you know, at a certain point there's a limit to that. So you what you do is you set them up as drug dealers, the same with the paramilitaries in Colombia. And of course, if you are drug dealing on behalf of the CIA or MI6, it's very it's a doddle, really, because you've got protection. So a lot of the risk involved is removed, because you've got a nod and a wink, and of course it's still illegal, and of course the whole enforcement mechanism is just to keep the competition out.
Well, so I asked Susan also about the who are these jihadis. I asked her a little bit about them, who are now in charge of Syria, as well as the Erdogan, the Turkish angle.
Ended up flying a lot of the Syrian fighters into Libya so that they would be removed from the Turkish territories and would be pushed out into northern Africa, where he gave them a free rein, he thought, to explode into Egypt and Tunisia. And so the idea was that the Turkish Ottoman, again, Turkish expansionism, the Ottoman Empire would rise from Libya and expand up north and down south, covering that entire coast, Algeria, Morocco, and that whole...
So you're saying that was Gaddafi's plan?
No, that was Erdogan's plan. See, and Erdogan was doing exactly there what he's doing right now, thinking that he was going to expand his territory. And of course, as you what you described about Libya is exactly what has happened. It has become balkanized and controlled by warlords. So they've got slave markets, and nobody can. The West is it's a disaster. It's a failed state now, and Libyan oil money is now controlled out of Egypt, ironically. But you see that Erdogan has not learned his lesson, and now he's doing the same thing in Syria. But he expects that's the expectation, and has not learned his lesson. And I think what you're seeing in Syria will be I see the Arabs flooding into Syria. I see the Arabs flooding into Syria for the sake of taking on Israel. I think Israel has made I think this is the high point of Israel's success. I think they have made a gross miscalculation, because Assad would not, now this was one thing that Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad both, and whether you like them or not, they both refused to allow their territories to be exploited by the jihadists for attacks on Israel. This was the one ironclad rule that they had, was that they would never tolerate any foreign entity or any civilian forces to use their territory to attack Israel. And now the people who you've handed this off, who have been handed this country, their entire reason for existing is to attack Israel. And you can say the Western media, the Los Angeles Times, the BBC can tell you anything about these people, and they can say, oh, they're not going to behead anybody anymore. Oh, women aren't going to wear the hijab anymore. They're going to be much more tolerant. But the one thing that these people, and that may be true, but the one thing that these people will never do is give up their fight against Israel. And they are going to be more open, because they're going to be more open to the women, to all the different cultures coming in for jihad on Israel. And I really, truly believe that you are going to see a major confrontation now, because the old saying, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The Arabs have watched for a year while Israel committed genocide and war crimes against Gaza and the Palestinian people. Whether you like the Arabs or not, that is genocide. Those are war crimes. This is an extermination policy. So each of these expectations are different. Turkey thinks they're going to control Syria. Syria thinks they're going to be independent and is determined to continue to be independent as a nation. They're very highly educated people. They are not going to allow to bend the knee to Erdogan. They are not going to allow themselves to be a caliphate any longer. That will not happen.
Well, we shall see. What do you think, Martin?
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the things that might happen is you've got a similar regime in Egypt to the one in Syria, in that the Sisi regime is based on the army, and the Muslim Brotherhood, who won the last democratic election in Egypt, have been, you know, they've got tens of thousands of political prisoners and loads of people. I mean, Morsi was hung, wasn't he?
Well, loads of their supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, the people who got Morsi to power, were executed.
That's right. But in other words, if this is a successful uprising in Syria, you could see a Muslim Brotherhood armed uprising in Egypt. But of course, they haven't got an Erdogan to help them, and there isn't the contiguity, you know, who would get the weaponry in and all the rest of it. I think my reading is like as with Richard Medhurst here, rather than with Susan Lindauer. These jihadis are fake jihadis. They are basically armed, trained and directed by Western intelligence services, and they've got direct contacts with Mossad. Now, in other words...
But they may be trying to start a war, mightn't they? In other words, trying to control both sides of the chessboard.
Well, yeah,
MI6 and the CIA don't they?
There's all sorts... I mean, frankly, Middle Eastern politics is very, very internecine. It's very hard to... You know, because people change sides, and there's more than...
You've got your jihadis on the ground now in Syria and elsewhere. You've also got Israel. But although the Israelis think that the jihadis are their enemy, and the jihadis...
No, they don't think they're their enemy.
The Israelis...
They've already said, we're willing to talk to you.
Well,
we've got no beef with Israel.
Well, that's what they're saying at the moment, the official view, right? But let's look at driller down a little bit. So you've got these completely conflicting organisations, and as we've just heard, although they've been quite quiet about it, these jihadis are there to I mean, they're certainly looking at Gaza and they're thinking, right, these Israelis have got to go, the Zionists have got to go, whether they're saying it publicly or not. Of course, that would be, maybe it would be rather silly for them to do that, because that would be encouraging attack
officially.
But you see, what I'm saying is that the Western deep state is looking at this saying, actually, if we can control both or have an influence with both the Israelis and with the jihadis, then we can get ourselves a nice little war cooked up here.
Well, I think that the jihadis and the Israelis have come to an understanding. That's why the Israelis have come in. They've got, and then Channel 4 this week were talking to a spokesperson for the new regime, not the leader. And they asked them twice, have you got no comment to make about the Israelis coming in and taking over?
Well, they don't want to tell anyone, do they? Anyway, another interesting person who's got things to say about all this is are the Russians. And in Doha, in Qatar, there was actually a rather nice, there's a forum of some sort at the beginning of the week, last weekend, where Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, was quizzed about what's been going on in Syria.
How much of a blow is it to Russia that so much territory has been lost in such a short period of time? Because Russia and the Soviet Union before it has been such a big backer of Syria. How much of a blow is it, and will you intervene further militarily, not just diplomatically?
Our country has been a very big backer, not only of Syria, but also of Iraq, of Libya, of Lebanon. And it is not our fault that all the resolutions which were adopted on the Middle East issues, some of them were not adopted. For example, Iraq was bombed out of the statehood without any discussion in the Security Council. It is not our fault that the biggest trend of the modern world, namely the fight against those who want to keep hegemony, And on the other hand, those who would like to live in a free world where the United Nations demand to respect sovereign equality of states is really implemented, be it BRICS, be it Shanghai Cooperation, be it Gulf Cooperation Council, ASEAN, and many others. So the fight of these two worlds, one phasing out and another one emerging, is not going without clashes. And the conflicts which were aggressive adventures which were launched by the US and its allies in Iraq, Libya, Palestine, because the behavior of the United States on what is going on in Palestine is absolutely unacceptable, invading Syria, all this is the repetition of the old, very old habit to create some havoc, some mess, and then to fish in the muddy waters. And the Middle East and Europe is not enough already. The NATO, under the United States command, pronounced last year at the summit that the security in Euro-Atlantic is indivisible from the security in Indo-Pacific region. So they already eye the entire Eurasian continent, including South China Sea, Strait of Taiwan, the Korean Peninsula. They are creating NATO-like military blocs. NATO infrastructure is being promoted to the region. This is a reflection of attempts not to allow the hegemony to phase out. But this is a fight against history. So yes, we are very much sorry for the Syrian people who became a subject of another geopolitical experiment. We are absolutely convinced of inadmissibility to use terrorists like Yad Tahrir al-Sham to achieve geopolitical purposes, as it is being done now with the organization of this offensive from the Idlib de-escalation area. But, you know, what we do in the world, maybe the mentality is different. The Americans, for them, I know them very well, for them, what is important, how they are perceived. And they always want to be perceived number one. When they tell something, everybody must say, yes, sir, whatever Uncle Sam decides. In our case, it's not about being concerned with the impression we make on the people. We do things in which we believe. And if we could help since 2015, could help to keep the Syrian state apart, if we could organize the process with Iranian and Turkey colleagues, which is called Astana process, and we met today, as you mentioned, this in itself was a very helpful process. Nothing goes smoothly in world diplomacy, but the events which we are witnessing today, they are clearly geared to undermine everything we have been doing during those years. And we are sorry not for the image which people see in the person of the Russian Federation or me personally, but we are very concerned with the fate of the Syrian people. We don't want them to follow the fate of Iraqis, of Libyans, and of other nations who were disturbed by the people desiring to keep their domination.
So there, he's pretty much said it himself, Martin. We had enough. We did what we could in Libya. We've done what we could in Syria.
Well, that's right. I mean, the real tragedy here is for the Syrian people, because there was no reason for any of this, just like there was no reason for the war in the Ukraine. It was quite feasible for some kind of political solution to be found in Syria, and the Russians, when they intervened, said, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to talk to the opposition. The way they approach people who took up arms against the regime is, put your arms down, and we will talk to you about what demands you may have. And they've always approached it in that way, and they've been talking to all of the groups in Syria, apart from ISIS, all along. So they're already in contact with this new lot. And they've apparently negotiated with them that they, you know, that they're not going to attack their bases.
So the Russians are cowardly and have pulled out finally.
They're not.
After,
their bases
are still
there.
They've been there ever since the Second World War.
Yes, and their bases are still there.
Yeah, well, really?
Well, they are at the moment, I've seen all the reports.
Okay, they are, Martin. You know, you don't be patronising. Yeah? There is reports I've seen that the Russians have been pulling out of Tartus, their naval base.
Their ships are offshore at the moment because they don't want to be shot at. Now, ultimately, they're talking to the people who might shoot at them and says, please don't shoot at us.
They're not going
to
go back, are they?
Well, maybe not. Maybe they're going to lose those bases. Mm. And, of course, if they do, MI6 and the Americans will be going, whoopee! But, of course, that doesn't mean World War III is over. In fact, there could be a big escalation on the Iranian front very shortly.
Yeah,
or the Ukrainian front.
No, I think you're right. The Russians could be back. They could easily be back in Syria at the moment. They're on the back foot. They're withdrawing, but they could be back.
Well, some of the Syrian loyalists who were loyal to the regime, well, they've gone inside the Russian air bases to avoid being beheaded. So they could perhaps come back out again, but armed. Who knows?
Well, maybe. What happened to the Syrian Arab army? This was supposed to be one of the great forces in the Middle East. Has it disappeared? Has it vanished into a puff of purple smoke?
Yeah, because the problem is it was a conscript army, apart from certain sections of it, like the Tiger Forces. And everybody in Syria, I mean, people in the army, they were getting $7 a month as their salary. And even the generals are getting $40 a month. And at a certain point, armies cannot fight if they can't feed themselves.
So I suppose, really, a lot of this is because there's been such strict sanctions on Syria.
Right.
The same thing, isn't it quite feasible that a similar kind of thing might happen in Lebanon? Lebanon is undergoing a horrific financial crisis.
What's happening at the moment is the Israelis are pushing into Syria so that they can go round southern Lebanon and then they can cut into the Bekaa Valley from Syria. And they're expecting that that's what they may do. Yeah. So, in other words, the war is just evolving. It's not necessarily over at all.
So, are the Israelis now, they've got an extra few thousand square miles to add to their greater Israel, have they?
Well, that's certainly the position Smotrich has said. He sees the road, you know, the greater Israel should extend all the way from Jerusalem to Damascus. So, they've got no... You know, in theory, the right wing in Israel wants as much land as they can grab. I mean, it's as plain as a pikestaff that's what their policy is. And of course, at the end of the Second World War, the principle was nobody is to grab anybody else's land. And that's supposedly why we hate the evil Putin, who's gone into the Ukraine to defend people who don't want to be Ukrainians. But the Israelis are going into everybody else's land nearby, and they don't want the Israelis there. But hey,
this is brilliant for the greater Israel bloc, this far-right bloc now controlling Israeli politics, will be rubbing their hands at this. This is actually a great success from their point of view. They first of all start by saying, oh, we're going to have to go into Syria because we need a buffer zone just so those jihadis don't come in. Then they start destroying loads of military equipment. And then now they're saying, oh, we're going to be there permanently now, or potentially for a long time. They first of all said, we'll be going back. Now they've changed their mind again. That Israel rejects French call to withdraw from the Syrian buffer zone.
Yes, but the British position, in contrast to the French position, is that Israel's got a right to defend itself.
Syria?
In Syria, yes.
Right.
That's apparently
so
opposition.
Russia's got a right to defend itself in Scotland, then?
Russia's got a right to defend itself in the Ukraine, certainly.
Well, if the Russians want to invade Scotland, they can...
Because it's got to be contiguous, you see. There's a threat. The Israelis can move... Because of these woke jihadis who are in favour of LGBTQ rights have taken over, but they're still jihadis. So although we've got to say, hey, great, isn't it wonderful that the jihadis have taken over? We've also got to say, but the jihadis are also, on the other hand, they're also terrible.
Yeah, but
so
hang
it's perfectly
on.
Justified for the Israelis to go in case these LGBTQ loving jihadis turn out to be proper jihadis. So we've got to hold two equal and opposite things in our mind at once and believe both to be true.
This is George Orwell, isn't it? Now, but what about Norway? So the Russians could go into Norway and say, this, because it's contiguous, we can take a big chunk of Norway to stop the Norwegians getting ready to invade Russia.
It's just a defensive manoeuvre, yeah. That's right.
That's right.
We're not invading Norway, we're just a defensive manoeuvre in case you invaded us. I mean, this is the sort of argument that was made all the way through the 19th century. These kind of rows are not new. They just keep
So
resurrecting.
I wonder how this has all been playing out in the British Parliament. Now, I suppose I should sort of apologise for not using Prime Minister's questions over for a long time, actually. We haven't even heard from Kerry Badenoch, the new Tory leader, on this show. But by having a listen to this, you might see why we don't really bother with PMQs and the British Parliament much anymore. Because of some of the, actually, particularly the questions seem to be so empty. Anyway, here is Ed Davey putting a question to Prime Minister Keir Starmer about Syria on Wednesday this week.
Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. While Syrians are rejoicing at the overthrow of the brutal Assad regime, many people there and around the world are worried about what comes next, as the Prime Minister indeed said, with the threats of extremism, ISIS terrorism and unsecured chemical weapons. Only an open political process can bring peace and stability, but that will require the full backing of the international community. So does the Prime Minister share my concern that President-elect Trump said about Syria, and I quote, the United States should have nothing to do with it? If America walks away and steps away, will he step up and work with other allies to provide British leadership over Syria?
Yes. Prime Minister.
He's right to say this is a very serious moment. We all welcome the fall of Assad. I hope this can be a turning point for Syria, a much-needed turning point, but that is by no means guaranteed, and that is why we've been speaking intently and intensely with our allies in the region across the globe about how we ensure that this is peaceful, it is political, and it's a rejection of terrorism and violence. This could be a turning point, but in the past we've always thought that what comes next is necessarily better. That hasn't turned out to be the case, and that's why we're working so hard on this and showing the leadership that he and the House would expect from this government.
Well, how about that for a non-answer? But anyway, there's all sorts of little points that Davey includes in there. Also, we've seen wall-to-wall on the TV this week, all this stuff about, oh, yes, this is the man who used chemical weapons against his own people. Everyone is glad to see that welcoming the end of Assad.
Well, I mean, there's no evidence that he did use chemical weapons.
In fact, the evidence is
that the jihadis used the chemical weapons in order to try and discredit Assad, and they killed loads of people.
And the white helmets were the people who fabricated the case against Assad.
That's right.
This is at Ghouta. Now, I think it was at Turkish.
And also at Douma.
So, two chemical weapons attacks.
The chemical weapons attack at Douma was faked. The one at Ghouta was real, but it was carried out by the jihadis.
Yeah, so this was all intertwined, wasn't it, back then with the attempt by the Americans to bomb and attack Syria.
Yes.
And there was a whole sort of pushback by, I think it was when Ed Miliband was leader of the opposition against Cameron.
Because in those days we had this idea that we're not going to go to war again after the Chilcot inquiry and the Iraq and all the rest of it without a proper vote in a vote in Parliament. And because the first time, if you remember, Putin arranged for Assad to decommission the chemical weapons that they did have. And of course, the evidence was that the Ghouta, the chemical weapons that actually used by the other side. And then the second time, the Douma was a fake. But of course, we still got, the Americans still fired some missiles into Syria, which they didn't fire back. Maybe they should have done. If I was Assad, I'd say, well, the problem with me, with what I've been doing, I've just been too nice. You know, if he'd been more determined to take on the West, then he might have won.
How? But
they could attack that base in Akrotiri, Tony, that shouldn't be there. The one that we pay for with our taxes when we can't afford dentistry. That one.
Actually the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, flew out there, didn't he?
Yes, he said, you're saving the...
Give them all a pat on the back.
No, he gave them all a pat on the back. He said, the whole world's relying on you. Keep on bombing those Yemeni targets. Yeah, the poorest country in the Middle East.
No, I'm talking about last weekend to do with Syria. No, he was out there.
Yes, but they're still bombing Yemen from Akrotiri. People forget what's going on, don't they? There's so many wars going on, we can't remember who we're supposed to be fighting. We're already at war with Yemen. And, of course, they would be absolutely justified in firing a missile back at that base, wouldn't they? especially in the canteen when they're all just having their dinner. Because you can't just go bombing other people and expect they're not going to bomb you back. A lot of people in this country are going to have a wake-up call in 2025.
Anyway, Starmer told the troops at the base deploying Gaza spy planes, the whole world is relying on you. He said he visited a controversial British airbase in Cyprus from which the Royal Air Force flies spy planes over Gaza. Now, they're not sending them over there to save Palestinians from the genocide. No, they're there to aid the Israelis. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has visited controversial British air base in Cyprus from whence the Royal Air Force sends spy planes over Gaza, telling British troops that the whole world relies on them. Well, we don't, certainly don't. Starmer's visit marks the first time a British Prime Minister has visited Cyprus in 53 years in an official capacity, and is considered important because the UK is a guarantor of power for the island, which is divided between the Republic of Cyprus and the self-proclaimed Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. He visited RAF Akrotiri, one of two British bases on Cyprus, on Tuesday this week, Martin. Starmer was filmed telling troops the whole world and everyone back home is relying on you.
Relying on them to carry on supporting the Israelis to kill people in Gaza.
Yes. Why, after 53 years, is it interesting that he chose this time to go there, isn't it, since we've just had this successful operation to overthrow Assad?
Well, I mean, everything is hotting up. And of course, you know, most people in this country are probably, some will be aware, but most will be unaware that we've got a base there. And they presume, well, surely it's just okay for us to have a base. I mean, people have bases. The Russians aren't allowed to have bases, by the way. But we are. We can have bases. Why should we be in the Middle East? Well, it's because we used to have an empire and Cyprus used to be part of it. And of course, the Cypriots did fight a war against us to kick us out in the 1950s. General Grivas, Aoka B, killed quite a few British soldiers because we don't want you here. And of course, the deal in 1962, I think it was you can have independence, although of course eventually the Turks come in and spoil that. But we've got to keep our base because, you know, we're an empire and we've got to keep some bases. And of course, the Cypriots don't necessarily want that base there. In fact, some guys from the base, not many years ago now, went out, you know, they raped a tourist and they tried to get into the base because they knew that they wouldn't be prosecuted if they did. The local police caught them and sent them down, but they'd raped and murdered the 16-year-old Danish Turk.
It's 50 years since the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, which was orchestrated by Henry Kissinger. Turkey remains the only country to recognise Northern Cyprus, which demands a two-state solution to the dispute. So no other countries actually recognise this northern part of Cyprus other than the Turks. The Turks obviously got a big hand in all this. In August, the Turkish, I think he's the foreign minister, said, when the UK withdrew from Cyprus, it took two sovereign bases through agreements. Because these bases have a sovereign status, no one can interfere. If British planes taking off from these bases get involved in certain issues, that could make Cyprus a target, the Turks said. This was in response to the Lebanon's Hezbollah warning Cyprus against allowing Israel to use its military infrastructure for drills. The Republic's government denied at the time that its country allowed Israel to use its airports and bases for military exercises. Early in June, Turkey's foreign minister Hakan Fidan said Ankara had received intelligence reports that indicated Cyprus had become a military base for operations in Gaza. So actually, we only really know about this because the Turks have leaked it to the world.
Yes, but I mean, if anybody's paying attention knows what that base has been doing for the Americans have been using it to resupply the Israeli army. So they send stuff in there, and then it's flown into Israel, and it's weaponry.
Let's just be clear: Akrotiri is in southern. It's in the old-fashioned Cyprus, not in Turkish Cyprus.
Yes.
So they're sort of ratting on their southern Cypriot neighbours.
Yeah, well, Turkish Foreign Minister pointed out, Akrotiri is sovereign British territory. Now, in other words, plenty of people in Cyprus saying, well, hang on a minute, why are you here? And, of course, a lot of people in Britain might ask the question, why are they there? We've got lots of problems here in Britain. You know, as we know, they've got the cut fuel payments, and the farmers are complaining that they don't want to pay too much more taxes, but we've got plenty of money to have a base in Cyprus. Surely you know, we need to learn to mind our own business and look after our own people. No, but we're an important country, you see, Tony. We can't just mind our own business.
I think I love
what we've got our duty to the Americans and the Israelis.
Of all of the commentary we've heard here, I think in a way I love Susan Lindauer as the best, where she says all these different powers, superpowers, local regional powers in Syria, have got different expectations. They've got different hopes. And look, just looking today, the Israeli military, obviously the Israelis are in a fairly strong position to grab loads of that land. Military storms, countryside villages and residents defy evacuation. So they're driving the people out, the Israelis, from that area. Syrian Democratic Force says it has deals with HTS and it will send a delegation to Damascus. What do you make of that?
I said earlier, there's a lot of negotiation going on. I mean, everybody's trying to make contact with this new regime, rebels, you know, whatever you want to call them, and they're sounding them out to see what is going to happen next.
A Kurdish-led administration in northeastern Syria has urged unity as the Turks attack them. So maybe they just see the Kurdish administration in northeastern Syria as a soft target. The Turks can then go and grab some of that territory.
It's not a soft target, it's a hard target, but they're determined to crack it. They do not want an independent Kurdish enclave in Syria, and they're determined to smash it. Now, therefore, the Kurds, if they talk to the, you know, Turkish protégés in Damascus, they're trying to, you know, get, you know, say, well, you know, why don't we have a national government and we can have an autonomy or something? The Turks are totally opposed to that. There was some suggestion that the Turks were starting to talk to the PKK, to Apple, or they call him Apo, which means uncle, who's in prison off the Turkish coast. And there was some talk of some rapprochement between them. But they're still at daggers drawn to a large extent. And as you say, they've been fighting this week. So, and of course, they've withdrawn from Deir ez-Zor, because the Americans wouldn't back the Kurds to fight the new Sham people. It's complicated. It's very similar to the Lebanese civil war many years ago, or even what went on in Bosnia when I was out there. There's more than one player. And we used to go to Bosnia and we'd get these maps. The British would put these maps up and show all the different areas. Lots of different areas. And if your map reading got, don't go down there because that's dangerous. You've got to stick to this highway here, all of this. And it's a patchwork quilt of armed groups.
Chemical weapons watchdog urges a probe into Syria after Assad al-Assad toppled. But we also hear the Israelis saying that they have found some kind of chemical weapons dump or a centre in the Golan Heights, which I find a bit surprising since the Israelis have been controlling that for a long time.
Well, it must be the bit of the Golan Heights that they've just, because they didn't control all of it, so they've captured another bit of it, and now they're claiming they've found chemical weapons. Well, the problem is, I just don't believe anything that they say. People can say anything. Oh, yes, we found these chemical weapons, but they may not have. They may have just been making it up, because that's what goes on all the time. And look what's happened in the Ukraine. They've just made up so much stuff, unbelievable, ridiculous stuff. And then when they get caught out, they say, oh, well, that was, we were lying then, but what we're telling you now, that's the truth. You've got to take all of it with a big pinch of salt.
So Israel is targeting the chemical weapons sites as former Syria Prime Minister pledges peaceful switch of power. The strikes come as the former PM said he has agreed to hand over power to the rebel group that toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime this week. Israel has carried out airstrikes and suspected chemical weapons sites and long-range rockets in Syria to keep them from falling into the hands of the extremists. So this is what
I thought they were woke. Oh, they're extremists when the Israelis are bombing them.
Sorry,
they're extremists.
Suspected chemical weapon sites, but not actual chemical weapon sites. The Israelis suspect them to be. Yes, and well, that's their excuse to go in and bomb them.
Well, I mean, they've got no basis in international law. They're not supposed to be in the Golan Heights at all. Well, the Americans have Trump recognised the Golan Heights as part of Israel. Nobody else does. They're not supposed to go into other people's countries. I mean, when Putin did that, there's total sanctions on the country. Total sanctions straight away. So obviously what we're going to do now is going to put sanctions on Israel, aren't we? Because they've invaded a country. We're going to put sanctions on them, aren't we, Tony? aren't we?
Well, maybe, maybe not. Let's just turn to Patrizia now, our resident poet, for her poem this week, which is on, it's called A Christmas Carve-Up. Imagine a carve-up. What a taku. Trump and now Putin perhaps deed did do. Syria the way for bullets and guns from Iran into Gaza always would come. Syria is yours, just give me Ukraine. Carve up the land and never explain. Syria's fallen, Jihad M a plan. Israel's expansion, BB main man. Middle East tied up, bribed and cajoled. World Cup the prize, regardless, own goal. Israel's US expansion, the plan marches on. No word on Gaza, Palestine be gone. USA, UK, enemies hold lines. Syrians now beaten, Gaza, their crime. A carve-up for Christmas with plenty of trimmings. The gangsters in charge now cash in their winnings. Donald in his counting house with Israel on call. Putin with borders now never to fall. Syria a deal with Israel now friends. Palestine needs help, whatever their end. The bridge is now broken, arms all be gone. Gaza bereft, Christmas no fun. A plan, some hope cooking, a goose overrun. Expansion of Israel, USA dusted and done. Thanks, Patrizia. She puts me in mind there of the Yinon plan, Martin. Surely this is just, I mean, that was 1982, I think, Oded Yinon's plan to balkanize the Middle East to allow Israel to expand. This just seems to be the latest station on that little road.
Absolutely. That's exactly what the goal is. If they can create lots of ethnic mini-states which are at war with each other, you know, Yugoslavia style, and of course they're an ethnic state as well, so they'll just be another ethnic state, yeah? You've got your Sunnis over here, your Shias over here, Jews over here. Of course, but we want, you know, but of course...
The other thing in the plan was porous borders, wasn't it?
That's right, well, yes, but they also...
The idea is no proper border. Everyone can kind of... Jihadis can run about wherever they feel like.
Because the point is that they can expand, you know, that Israel can expand. I mean, they're basically land grabbing, yeah? Now, the whole of international law is actually set up after World War II to prevent this kind of thing from happening. But there they are doing it.
And if they get away with it,
nuclear
of course,
weapons.
If they get away with it, then this encourages more of this, doesn't it?
It does. Well, the more they get away with, the more, and of course they're in for a penny, in for a pound now. They're pushing very strongly for a direct war with Iran now, because the talk in deep state circles in Israel and the West is that Iran and Russia are on the back foot now. So now is the moment to really go for it. And of course, first in the targets would be Iran, who haven't fired back yet for their last attack on them. But the Israelis make, because they can now overfly Syria, of course. Previously, that was a bit difficult for them to do. They can now overfly Syria. They can get much, much closer to Iran by coming in that way round. And they can get into Lebanon. They can get into the Bekaa Valley, go round the Hezbollah defences that have been put up in southern Lebanon. Are you following me? They can do all of these things, and that's why they're probably going to go for it. But, of course, the Iranians will fight back. And they can fight back.
But what
they
about,
could, for
what
example,
about the
hit Akrotiri from Iran, no problem, with a missile.
What about the victims of Assad? Because it's quite clear there were a lot of people locked up in those prisons, although there was one person who was put out on the news as an American who was freed from one of the jails, a US citizen freed from Syrian prison, identified as Travis Timmerman. No, that is his proper name, not Austin Tice, as was first reported. So they got his name wrong. And actually, some people have pointed out that some of these people are being interviewed who've just been freed from the prisons. I think it was, I can't remember who now, but somebody mentioned that they actually look quite healthy, like, didn't look like they'd been in prison for a decade or something. Coming out of a darkened prison, they had quite a good, nice complexion and this sort of thing. So there's questions about whether there is some news management going on.
Well, there is massive news management going on, so it's very hard to know what the reality is. Don't forget that what would have been in Assad's prisons is quite a lot of ISIS prisoners and similar of that. So they've all been released now. So that's good. Yeah. They can get back to jihading.
They certainly can. Well, Susan, when I spoke to her yesterday, told me of a very sad announcement. Sorry to announce the death of Scott Bennett. Scott was been on this show many times. He was on the program actually back in June, and he was over in Ukraine, Martin, taking a very good look at some of the war crimes by the Ukrainian forces in Ukraine itself, which is obviously a bit of a dangerous thing for a former US Army officer to be doing. He flew back to the United States, which was taken straight into a hospital with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, apparently, and then died 2 days after he arrived back in America in hospital, aged 54.
Well, that's sad. I don't think we necessarily presume that he was done in, but he may have been.
Who said that?
Well, I don't know. I'm just suspicious.
Susan knew him quite well. She says he was healthy as an ox until he suddenly died.
Well, we know. I mean, in Latin America, people widely believe that Hugo Chavez was basically given cancer 3 times. They had 3 very weird and wonderful cancers. The Cuban doctors cured him of the first 2, but they couldn't cure him of the 3rd one. And various other left-wing leaders in Latin America died of very bizarre, obscure cancers. Many people in Latin America believe that they were indeed given cancer by their enemies. So it's perfectly feasible that that might happen.
He was a psychological warfare officer. One of the most important things he revealed was what I think I'll do, if it's not too massive a file, I don't think it is he wrote a book, I think it was in 2013, called Shell Game, which was sort of built on what Susan had done in the early days, looking at the funding for these jihadi networks and for Al-Qaeda. He showed that CENTCOM, this is the American Unified Command Structure, which is American military's projection of power all around the world in a kind of map. CENTCOM is the Middle East command. They're based at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. That CENTCOM had been working very, very closely with Booz Allen Hamilton, who Scott worked for, and UBS in Switzerland, Union Bank of Switzerland, to run secret accounts to fund all these jihadi groups. And his book Shell Game explains that that's exactly the sort of thing he was investigating when he was forced to resign from the military in America, because it was quite clear that this was a covert program using Swiss banks to finance jihadis with American money, and much of it coming through Switzerland.
Yes, I think it's very hard for the ordinary brainwashed population to understand that the most extreme jihadi groups are basically puppets of Western intelligence services. And they said, well, why did they allow them to carry out attacks inside the West? That's because you are being terrorised. You, ordinary population, are being terrorised. A bomb goes off in Manchester Arena. It causes huge suffering. Everybody's completely shocked and awed, all the rest of it. And, of course, the deep state takes another step to the full control of both the British population and the wider empire strategy. And that's been going on for a long time. People who listen to this show will know that that is, in fact, the game and has been the game all along.
But people like Scott are pretty rare, and it's very brave of him, really, to go to Ukraine to gather this information about Ukrainian army war crimes.
It is, but I suppose he might imagine that being the US citizen and so on, and ex-military, he might get some level of protection. But of course, the Ukrainians actually openly put them on this website that they have of who their enemies are, and they openly call for people to kill them. So Scott Ritter's on their on this website, and various other people are on it. They're not very nice people, and of course, Ukrainian drone operators were with the jihadis in Syria. That was one of the reasons why they were able to advance so quickly, because they got advanced drones which were directly supplied from the Ukraine.
This whole business of I mean, Booz Allen Hamilton's quite interesting. Isn't this the company that Edward Snowden was working for? They're obviously...
Dick Cheney was chief...
It seems quite obvious to me that all the dodgy stuff, because there's an oversight by the Senate, the House of Representatives, but particularly the Senate, of these military institutions in the States, that they're just basically farming out all these black operations and money laundering, etc., which this is, and terrorist financing from the United States to these little private businesses.
Well, that's how you do it, isn't it? I mean, that's what you're going to do, that's the way you do it. So the National Endowment for Democracy goes out and does openly what the CIA used to do covertly. So in Georgia, for example, they fund loads and loads of journalists like us, for example, but they're paid. The National Endowment for Democracy pays them to criticise the local government, blah, blah, blah. So that stuff used to be done under the table. That's done over the table now. Then you've got the shell companies for supplying weaponry and funds to jihadis, like all of the weaponry from Bulgaria that ended up in the hands of ISIS, traced by Dilyana Gatasheva. And then you've got the really dark stuff, where they're actually facilitating drug dealing, like Carlos Castano in Colombia, who's working for the CIA, effectively, and setting up paramilitary groups along with the Israelis to assassinate social movement people in Colombia. And the whole of the Western deep state is a vast gangster enterprise, with all of the kind of things you might expect a gangster enterprise to have, hitmen and all the rest of it. It's shocking.
But it's the point at which it meets the funding, which is taxpayers' money, and also money raised by the government from the financial centres like the City and Wall Street for these sorts of operations. Now, last week we had a whole sort of section on the City of London and the operations of these financial elites, where they are basically massive amount of backslapping with people like Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, and Prime Minister Keir Starmer in there too. Isn't this quite an important ingredient in this hideous world that we've created here in the West? Really, it's a kind of fascist system, really, where public money is just used for big corporations like BlackRock to create these disaster capitalism wars, which they can then cash in on.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Money talks. Money doesn't talk, it swears, as Bob Dylan famously said. I mean, this is what it's all about. And of course, if you're a politician of any kind, you need funds to get elected. So where are you going to get those funds from? Well, it comes from the people with the money, both dirty and not so dirty. And of course, when they pay for stuff, they expect to get something back for it. You know, so George Soros was very much involved. He wasn't the only one involved in funding the Maidan coup in Ukraine. And of course, the payoff for him, having funded it through the Open Society Foundation, is he gets lucrative contracts to buy up stuff when it's all privatized and all the rest of it. And of course, I noticed that the moderate rebels in their woke manifestation have said that Syria is open for business, and you know they're not going to go back to the old system where there was free healthcare and all that. We're going to be a modern country with no free healthcare.
Are they going to have American private health campus like United Healthcare?
Yeah, so obviously, that's the future.
So this is a disaster for them, really.
Disaster for the Syrian people. Yes,
yes, that's what I mean. Yeah,
I mean the whole thing's been a disaster for them. And it's a tragedy, but it's also a disgrace, because we in the comfortable West have inflicted all of this on these people, and then we all want to go home and have a nice cup of tea. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, well, sorry to report the death of Scott Bennett, as we were just talking about there. What I will do is an absolutely brilliant piece done by Stephen Pidgeon, which is called Scott Bennett Saying Goodbye to a Friend. So I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you want to have a listen to his tribute to Scott and all the work he's done. But for my part, I'd quite like to play a couple of excerpts from what we heard from Scott earlier this year. And to start with, one where he talks... hear about a little bit about the West's mainstream media and the way that the media operates. Of course, he, as a psychological warfare officer, knew all about, we need to just get this out through the mass media and convince everybody of some complete lie, which serves our geopolitical purpose.
The media has totally transformed over the last 10, 20 years into more of a government stenographer, a government reporting system. It is not independent scholars or researchers digging into issues or events or people or phenomenon in order to arrive at an interesting, truthful, revelatory position on a subject. That those days are gone. I think they've been gone since the 1970s. What we have instead is a stunted class of bloated, bureaucratic-minded regurgitators that simply regurgitate the strategic communications pamphlets and talking points and reports that come out of the CIA, MI6, MI5, the various intelligence agencies in the EU, NATO, American Alliance, the Five Eye Alliance. That's what the media has transformed into. That's why many have left the mainstream media, including people like Tucker Carlson, Judge Napolitano, Redacted, on and on and on. Many independent voices have left the mainstream media because they've been persecuted or they've been fired. So it's because the mainstream media has adopted a position of subservience to government and government money and the money behind the government people, that they've abandoned all of their independence and integrity. So there is no truth on the Western mainstream media. I would say the only places that you really do see examples of truth are on Press TV, RT, Sputnik, some of the more Russian channels. And that's been my experience as a commentator. I've never been told what to say or what to think. I've always spoken my mind.
Rest in peace, Scott Bennett. Martin, this is absolutely, he's hit the nail on the head there, hasn't he, with using this term strategic communications. Now, our once free press has been actually co-opted to simply be used to force down people's throats, whatever it is the fascists in charge, whether that's arms companies, whether it's the finance capitalists, whether it's their puppets in government, the World Economic Forum, down our throats.
Well, that's right. I mean, as Noam Chomsky pointed out a long time ago, I mean, the media is a business, and ultimately they are there to sell you stuff, including lies. And, that's what they're selling.
Anyway, so he died just after returning from his trip to Ukraine. And when I spoke to Scott back in June this year, I was also talking to him about Ukraine. So here's a final comment from Scott for now. Like I say, I'll put up a full version of the interview I did with Scott back in June, and also this other one by, what was his name, Mr. Pigeon, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But for now, Scott on Ukraine.
Russia has never wanted a war or a conflict since 2014. It has been pushed upon Russia by the NATO powers, who were using Ukraine as a bulwark, as a Trojan horse, if you will, to penetrate more deeply Russia and inevitably trigger a social political collapse and change of the guard. That's always been at the heart of these globalist mindsets, because Russia represents a nation of Christian values, and it is no longer communist or left-wing. It is, in fact, more of a conservative Christian nation, resembling what was under the Tsar Nicholas time, than any other time in history. And that makes them very hated. They don't embrace the LGBT transgender wokeness agenda. And as a result, they've won the majority of the world's nations to their side. They've won Africa. They've won the Middle East. They've won Asia, with China leading. The only nations that oppose Russia are the tantrum-like childish Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the Baltic nations, and of course the French, German, you know, British arrogant imperialists that think that, you know, society is still back in the 1700s. So all of this animosity towards Russia is translating into military kinetic activities, but that too is lost. Ukraine has lost the war. It doesn't have any more men. It doesn't have any more material. Zelensky is not the president anymore. His term has expired. He's a dead man walking. It's only a matter of time before he's killed, skinned alive, hung by the neck, and treated like Mussolini by his own people.
Hang on, he's not going to be. He's going to go and retire on a swanky yacht and a nice villa in Florida.
Yeah, I don't think they'll let him. I think he will find a very grisly end if the Russians... but again, the Russians have said it won't be them, it'll be the Ukrainians, and you could understand why when he's killed 500,000 of them needlessly. He's absolutely a disloyal person. It doesn't care about Ukraine. He cares about the United States giving him money. And
yeah,
the next
let me drag you back, because we did have this whole situation... in 2022, in February, where the Russians were deliberately provoked into the war in the Donbass, to what they call the special military operation, invading Ukraine to defend the Donbass region. As the Ukrainian army was about to attack, the Russians moved in to protect those people. In a similar way, the Russians have a limited number of these ballistic missile defense radars, which are absolutely crucial in defending Russia from a ballistic missile nuclear attack by NATO. And so how many of these are going to be taken out before the Russians say, right, well, we're going to have to destroy Filingdales, or we're going to have to destroy one of the radar bases in the western United States, Scott?
Well, that's where things are inching along in a way that Russia doesn't want it to happen, and the West is either suicidal and wanting it to happen, again, for the alternative political motive of creating the conditions that they can declare martial law and control their own people. So in one cynical sense, all of this belligerency displayed against Russia in a foreign policy circle, one could make the argument, is entirely designed to exercise social political control and collapse of their own country in the United States, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Canada, and Australia. It seems completely out of any sense of historical logic when we come back to what the West is supposed to represent. But though that representation no longer exists, it's not 1970 or 1980 anymore. It is now 2024 with the woke, schizophrenic, overly COVID-19 vaccinated and boosted class of people living in the West that I think are the sickest, dumbest, most confused and schizophrenic people that have ever walked the earth. And Russia has a weakness in being able to fully understand the depth of depravity that exists in much of the West. And I've witnessed this for over 40, 50 years. So I do think Ukraine is going to continue this until their potential annihilation and you know, removal of Zelensky. I do think they're going to set off a nuclear event at the Zaporizhzhia plant next. I think they're going to do that to try and create a excuse to pretend that Russia set it off. Russia, you know, blew up the Zaporizhzhia, but I think it'll end up being similar to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline when the West, specifically the United States, blew up the Nord Stream pipeline that was going to Germany, effectively declaring war on Germany. Then again, Germany has no sense of pride. It's a vassal state, and Olaf Scholz committed treason against his own people by allowing that to happen. So we're witnessing a complete implosion of loyalty, common sense, and devotion to the people among these Western government nations.
Well, rest in peace, Scott Bennett. Very sad to see, like I say, died very early, age 54. Another voice, Martin, I'm afraid we won't be hearing from again. A very sane and extremely intelligent insider was explaining to us what's going on.
Yes, it is a shame. That's very young for him to go. And of course, it's all very well. We're outsiders critiquing, but somebody like him who's been inside the structure has got more credibility to speak because they know very well exactly how it works from first hand.
I wonder if it is possible to for the Ukrainians to simply poisoned him somehow, given him pancreatic cancer over
it's
in
possible.
Ukraine.
We've already hinted at that, but I mean, you know, there's no point in saying any more than that, is there really?
So let's go to Gaza now, and which is in a way is the heart of all of this, which seems to me to be the hideous human sacrifice fuse which the elite in the West are trying to use to ignite a third world war, and certainly massively increased tensions by expanding Israel's territory, this extremely dangerous nuclear armed doomsday cult in the Middle East. It's the 16th of October group, which was started by Wafa al-Udaini, the journalist who was killed. She was doing reports for this program back in November, October, the end of October, beginning of November this year. And thankfully, there are other people who are doing reports for us now from Gaza. Well, it's great to actually be able to hear what people in Gaza are saying, Martin, isn't it? You know, from this is something I suppose you can do nowadays. We're hearing virtually nothing from inside Gaza, and what it is, it seems to me, is a sort of almost a sanitized version of what's happening. But anyway, so before we hear your commentary and we go to a break, Martin, let's have a listen now to Fatima's report this week, where she's talking here a lot about what it's like for children and young people in Gaza right now, the genocide zone where the Israelis have killed now something like 50,000 people, possibly double that.
Hi, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of a freedom in northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. May Almighty Allah protect us and this Israeli genocidal war comes to an end. 14 months ago until now, Israel continues its genocidal war against Palestinian people in the beleaguered Gaza Strip. And it claimed the lives of more than 44,363 Palestinians and injured 105,070 others. Israel has killed or maimed at least 6% of Palestinians in Gaza. And it has killed 17,581 children in Gaza, while 223 infants were born and killed during the genocide. And according to UNRWA, Gaza has the highest number of child amputees per capita anywhere in the world. Many of these children have lost limbs and undergone surgery without anesthesia and have no access to rehabilitation services to cope with the life-altering injuries caused by this genocidal war. This genocide has deprived Palestinians, especially children, from older rights, while human rights organizations did nothing but keep silent. The Western leaders who claimed being democrats ignored our my people's plight, and the Western mainstream media prefer to make our suffering and harsh reality unnoticed, but I promote the fake Israeli propaganda. To give you a personal example, but it shows the reality and harsh reality of and suffering of the Palestinian children in Gaza under the Israeli genocide. My little sister has lost the source of unconditional love, and it is not her, but as she's a little and she's at a very young age, so this has affected her more than us, the rest of my family. She lost the source of unconditional love after my mother passed away due to her illness that she has been diagnosed with due to fear during this genocide. But the lack of medicine and medical supplies and the Israeli systematic policy of detaining the medical staff contributed at exacerbating her already worse health condition. My sister needs psychological care after the trauma she's enduring due to this loss. She also lost her right to education after the educational institutions turned into makeshift shelters. She lost her right to live a healthy life after we have been forcibly displaced of our house since the beginning of this genocide. And this is, as I said, not just the suffering of my sister. This is like it shows the suffering of every single child in the Gaza Strip in light of this genocide. 14 months later, Israel still imposes severe restrictions on Gaza City and the northern part of the Strip, allowing only limited amounts of international aid, barely enough to keep residents alive. However, all the residents there suffer from malnutrition and severe vitamin deficiencies. In Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip, since the beginning of October 2024, Israeli occupation has completely banned the entry of food and water, imposing a suffocating siege on the area as it works to empty it of residents. When residents attempt to leave their homes in search of food or water, they are directly targeted by Israel drones, snipers, aircraft, or even artillery shelling. And according to UNRWA, displaced people in Gaza need protection from the rain and cold. Only around 23% of this need has been met, leaving 944,000 people at risk of exposure this winter. According to the Euromed Monitor, the humanitarian zone in central and southern Gaza, Israel has adopted a new strategy. While publicly claiming to allow dozens of aid and goods trucks into the area, the Israeli military permits organized armed gangs to access locations that regular residents are forbidden from reaching under threat of execution. These gangs loot the trucks before they reach their intended destinations, exacerbating the ongoing starvation crisis. Hundreds of Palestinians throughout the Gaza Strip, including in the so-called humanitarian zone, have died due to the severe malnutrition, particularly children and the elderly.
So that's the first part of Fatima's report this week, Martin. I just find it absolutely fascinating hearing directly from people in Gaza what they're talking about. This, what she was saying there about the these gangs being allowed by the Israelis to raid the trucks before they actually get to the people that need the food.
Yeah, I believe some while ago they killed the Hamas appointed police chief in Gaza because he was organizing, you know, they and I've also read that the Israelis themselves know that as soon as they clear out of an area, Hamas come out of the tunnels and start taking over again. And of course they were, you know, making sure that people queued up in an orderly fashion to get whatever food was coming in, and the Israelis deliberately targeted him so that that wouldn't happen. And of course, they've now encouraged these people to loot the trucks so that people, you know, that Hamas can't, you know, by using the aid to distribute the aid, you know, retain any kind of control of the population. But it's a pretty gruesome situation, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. All genocides throughout history have been, including the ones that have been directly done by the Brits, like the Russian at the UN was pointing out in North America, the mass murder of millions of Native Americans. I mean, interesting stories popping out this week before we hear from Fatima again. Queen Elizabeth refused to allow Israeli officials inside Buckingham Palace, apparently. This is in various national newspapers on their websites. I'm not sure it was in the papers themselves. Former Israeli President Reuven Rivlin says the late British monarch thought that every Israeli was either a terrorist or the son of a terrorist, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is out there. I don't know whether I believe everything I read or hear in the newspapers or on the, but of course the British state, we did in fact we've already been to war with Israel. Just like we've been to war with the people in Cyprus, and we're now at war with the people in Yemen.
The rest of the story, then, if you think that this is not true. The late Queen Elizabeth believed every Israeli was either a terrorist or the son of a terrorist, and refused to allow Israeli officials into Buckingham Palace. The former Israeli president, Reuven Rivlin, said the relationship between Israel and Queen Elizabeth was a little bit difficult, he says. He told an event celebrating Haifa's Technion Institute of Technology in London this week. Rivlin served as the 10th president of Israel between 2014 and 2021. whilst the Queen died in 2022. The former president said the Queen believed every one of us was either a terrorist or the son of a terrorist, adding she refused to accept any Israeli officials into Buckingham Palace apart from on international occasions. History of strained relations. Later asked about his comments, he doubled down on them. He says, these are my words. This is what I said. The Queen was often thought to have had a strained relationship with Israel, despite her visiting more than 120 countries and travelling around a million miles during her 70 years on the throne. She never visited Israel. In September 2022, after Elizabeth's death, Stuart Pollack, the honorary president of the influential Conservative Friends of Israel group, claimed that the royal family were prohibited by the Foreign Office from visiting Israel. Others have given alternative interpretations. Writing in 2012, the former Haaretz editor-in-chief, David Landau, said the marvellous, dedicated 86-year-old sovereign is nobody's puppet. If she wanted to visit the Jewish state or have one of her close family visit it, she could have insisted on it and got her way. So, anyway, this is quite interesting because it's a very, very different picture now with Charles, who has, of course, visited.
Yes, I mean, Charles has been in Israel, as far as I know.
Yes, he most definitely has, yeah. The far-right rabbis, chit-chatting with them.
Yes, well, don't forget that Queen Elizabeth was, you know, a young woman during the 1940s when the Israelis were, you know, openly killing British military personnel, police officers.
And some soldiers, of her friends, most probably.
And probably some people she knew. Yeah. That's right.
Israeli army chief given special immunity to visit Britain. Exclusive to declassified UK, bless them. A IDF chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, was given a special mission certificate for his trip to the UK last month, allowing him to visit without fear of arrest for war crimes. The UK government confirmed Israel's top soldier, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, has given special diplomatic immunity to visit Britain. He's the chief of general staff of the Israeli Defence Force and has been directing the Israeli military's genocide. Well, they just say operations throughout the Gaza genocide. Well, they do say it there. He arrived in Britain in late November to discuss the ongoing conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza with senior UK officials from the MOD and Foreign Office. A further meeting was held with Britain's Attorney General, Richard Hermer. Why wasn't he arrested then?
Well, because what they've got is, in theory, he could be arrested, but in practice, what the British have said to them, both this government and the previous government, is if we give you a waiver to come in, because in actual fact, you know, we don't want you to be arrested, so we're going to protect you. So that's what they do.
But of course, so we are complicit. We're absolutely complicit
with
this.
We're absolutely complicit.
And we are war criminals in the Foreign Office and in the Ministry of Defence and the Attorney General are all war criminals for offering succour to these genocidalists.
That's
like this. This guy is most definitely a prime candidate for Nuremberg.
Yeah. But there we are. They're getting some problems with the illegal position now. But nevertheless, they are protected by Britain in particular is known to be, you know, we are very much complicit in what they're doing. And of course, at the end of World War III, when the West has lost, there may well be, as you say, some kind of a reckoning for those who went along with all these things.
And also in a website, a US website called the Libertarian Institute, to those who know, this is a brilliant article, I thought, America's Syrian Gulag. To those that know about the United States' continued presence in Syria, supporting the Kurdish separatists and their military known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. So that sounds all nice, doesn't it? But they are, of course, not. Commonly said, the American motive is to steal Syrian oil and grain. One would also wonder how much the 900 soldiers the Americans have there could accomplish. But, of course, as usual, they're actually there as hostages to ensure that Syria cannot try to retake this area without killing Americans and thus unleashing the wrath of the US government. This is an interesting concept, isn't it? Using the US Army as kind of human shields.
Yes, and of course Trump openly said it in his first term, well, we're going to stay in Syria to steal the oil. He says this the quiet bit out loud, doesn't he, Trump?
But this article is actually about another aspect to all of this, which is the prison network, which is providing another important angle to the occupation. While the prisons in Syrian Kurdistan are not secret, they're also not well known. CNN recently did an excellent investigation exposing that more than 50,000 humans are kept in a network of 27 facilities in Syria. CNN's chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward was given rare access to these American prisons in her reporting. It's illuminating. All of the inmates are denied access to any form of legal process and have no chance of release, beside a vague hope that their home countries might repatriate them. Everything the US has done in Syria, of course, has been done in the name of human rights, but it seems to be the case that all of those individuals would have had a better chance of receiving some form of trial and definite sentencing under the government of Syrian Arab Republic. At the very least, they could not be denied a legal process to a greater extent than they currently are. So this is quite fascinating, isn't it? The Americans have got these kind of prison networks where they think something like 50,000 people are in there. In fact, the article goes on to talk about how they're very, very nice. They were kind of newly built, these places, but they've got 50,000 Syrians sitting in there.
Well, they're not all Syrians. A lot of them are from outside Syria, and they can't... They're countries.
Are these some of the people that may have now been let out, do you think?
Well, no, because this part of Syria is not under the control of the new regime. It's under the control of the Syrian Democratic Forces, as you said, or YPG.
Anyway, the article's called America's Syrian Gulag, so this is something I didn't know
They've
about.
They've got loads and loads and loads of what were ISIS inside prisons, because they didn't execute them, they just put them in prisons. And of course, many of them are from outside Syria, you know, from places like Chechnya and Uzbekistan and places like that. And those countries don't want them back. We don't want back
Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum. So,
Problem people.
They're just problem people. Yeah. So the Kurdish.
So they put in a kind of factory,
And of course, they have released some. And they've not released others. But of course,
this is one of the reasons the Russians want out, isn't it? They just don't want to be involved. It's getting murkier and murkier down there.
Well, that's right. And there's no point, you know, going to war is not just a question of being on the right side. It's also, well, what's the point? Are we going to win, or are we just going to get ourselves bogged down? Those kind of decisions, you know, have to be taken on a pragmatic basis, don't they?
So before we hear finally, before the break, from Fatima again, fascinating story. Starmer appoints an ex-Murdoch hack as strategic communications chief for the Labour Party. Hot on the heels of promoting the hard-right saboteur of Jeremy Corbyn, Morgan McSweeney, to be his chief of staff after the resignation of Sue Gray, Keir Starmer has appointed former Murdoch hack James Lyons as his head of strategic communications. Lyons worked as political editor Murdoch's Sunday Times, played a part in promulgating the Labour anti-Semitism smear, which McSweeney was confirmed recently to have orchestrated, writing for the Sunday Times in 2016 that Corbyn's son Tommy was the centre of a row over anti-Semitism at York University because he'd organised a play about Israel's bombing of Gaza. In early 2017, Lyons was also caught plotting against Corbyn in a conversation on a crowded train with one of the most notorious right-wing councillors at that time on Labour's national executive. So there are various previous stories about this guy, Lyons. Starmer has been widely and rightly condemned for his cosiness with Murdoch, including killing part two of the Leveson inquiry into press wrongdoing at his behest and writing repeatedly for the hated anti-working class SUN, which they don't. This is Squawkbox writing this, Martin. Interesting, isn't it? Murdoch, I'm going to do next week, this will be the final show before Christmas, we'll have a clip about Murdoch by Laurie Flynn. Laurie is an ex-World in Action producer and journalist, and he has all sorts of interesting things to say about the Murdoch Empire. So we'll leave that one till next week. But this is interesting, isn't it? The Murdoch Empire has been absolutely key, hasn't it, as a way of the mass media getting behind the Israeli genocide. They refuse to call it genocide in any of the Murdoch press.
Yeah, that's right. During the Blair era, I can't remember if it was Blair or one of the other his cabinet ministers. Well, Murdoch was the 11th member of the cabinet. You know, we didn't do anything without phoning Murdoch and asking him first.
Asking Rupert, what does Rupert think?
What does Rupert think? Yeah,
very good. I think that thing from Dominic Cummings last week, where he's talking about just what a sham this cabinet government is. Anyway, just before the break, let's hear finally from Fatima. Where she's talking about the hostages that the Israelis are holding from the Palestinian population.
To talk about the Palestinian detainees, especially the detainees and the Sdeita Imam prison or concentration camp that Israel occupation created for the prisoners they have been kidnapped from Gaza. In a statement published on Sunday, the Palestinian Commission over Prisoners and Ex-Prisoners Affairs warned that female detainees are facing inhumane and unethical treatment in the Israeli Damone prison. The Palestinian women face psychological abuse in the form of rape threats, strip searches, curses, beating and starvation. The commission's legal team documented the treatment after visiting the prisons where the abuse has intensified. And according to lawyers, Palestinian detainees are being forced to drink toilet water. While according to testimonies from released detainees, the extent of torture being experienced by Palestinian detainees at the hands of Israeli forces is unimaginable. This includes starvation, physical abuse, sexual assault, sleep deprivation by playing disco music nonstop, denial of water. Some detainees stayed in the same clothes for 8 months. Skin diseases have spread and there are no medics allowed. Not even the Red Cross. At least 10,000 of Palestinian detainees were kidnapped in the last 14 months alone. This includes children and pregnant women. Recently, Amnesty International has issued a report concludes that Israeli authorities are committed and are still committing genocide against Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip. And the Amnesty International USA said that by continuing to transfer arms to Israel, the U.S. government is violating its obligation to prevent genocide and risks being complicit. While for Secretary General of Amnesty International, Agnes Callamard, said that Amnesty International's report demonstrates that Israel has carried out acts prohibited under the Genocide Convention with a specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza. These acts include killings, causing serious bodily or mental harm, and deliberately inflicting on Palestinians in Gaza conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction. Month after month, Israel has treated Palestinians in Gaza as a subhuman group unworthy of human rights and dignity, demonstrating its intent to physically destroy them. And finally, I want to thank, in behalf of my people, the UN rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, for her efforts at exposing the Israel occupation genocidal actions. And we are so gratitude for her extraordinary solidarity with us, especially when she challenged the Zionists who relentlessly attempted to cancel her meeting that she has been hosted. To speak out about the genocide in Gaza at the University of Vienna. At the end of this report, I pray this genocide comes to an end and all Palestine gets freedom from the river to the sea. Palestine will be free. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fatima. So, I mean, in a way, as she's saying at the end, all we can do is pray, really. We don't really see much action from the international community. Lots of good words and also praise for Albanese, the lady from the United Nations, human rights woman. But at the end of the day, praying is what they're left with.
Well, that's, as you say, all they've got. And you were saying that this is actually exclusive to us, this interview.
Fatima is passing these to us, yeah, through the 16th of October group.
Yeah.
In a way, I suppose, you know, it's a sort of a bit of gratitude for working with Wafa over the years, who was killed a couple of months ago by the Israelis, and to make sure that the voices of Gazans can still be heard in the West here.
Well, it's a privilege to be able to participate in allowing that voice to be heard. Well, I mean, obviously, the war isn't over. I mean, the Hamas fighters are still in the tunnels. Hezbollah still exists. Iran is still to decide what it's going to do in terms of what it's, you know, revenge on Israel for the attack, the previous attack on them. It's not over till it's over.
The obvious question is, do you think there's any hope in what's happened in Syria for people in Gaza?
Probably not in the short run. But of course, the real game changer here could be if Iran comes in swinging, because they have got the kit to actually waste the Israeli army from a distance, and there's nothing the Israelis could do about it. Of course, at the moment, you've got a very reformist and cautious leadership in Iran that have got their own reasons not to want a war. But I think at some point they may be pushed, and if they are pushed, they have got the possibility they could take on the Israeli army. If they're then British and the Americans joined in, that could then precipitate a general conflict.
I suppose the British might. I think to a large extent, I think that the armed forces are thinking to themselves, well, we would much rather not have to actually come in behind the Israelis, because this might actually cause a few problems in the ranks, because quite a lot of soldiers would be reluctant to go and participate in a genocide. So it's much better to give financial support and these sorts of support rather than to say, right, okay, we're now going to back the Israelis this genocide.
I'm afraid the people in RAF Akrotiri are already participating and they're already legitimate targets.
Well, I think there's a lot of disillusion, I think, also amongst the armed forces about the way things are going, almost like we're the complete opposite of what we were supposed to be doing. And a lot of US veterans have been demoralized.
Every military guy who I talk to, every single one of them, I talk to a lot of them, they're all totally demoralized on the mission. And they know better than everybody else that all of these wars, the terror wars of the last 20 years, were all nonsense.
Afghanistan,
man,
was horrible.
Look, I mean, we got hit on 9/11 by a group of Sunni radicals, and then we went around the Middle East overthrowing regimes that had nothing to do with it, or trying to and then losing. The Taliban didn't hit us on 9/11. The special ops had taken out the Al-Qaeda camps by Christmas of 2001. And then the next 20 years we spent fighting a regime change war against the Taliban, who is essentially as guilty as a landlord who rented an apartment to a murderer. Well, like, that was basically their crime.
Amen to that.
Not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have. God bless the child that's got his own will. That's got his own. And the strong seem to get more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, and Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. And when you got money, you got lots of friends. Crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
Of beds when all there were tears of joy and laughter. People shouted, let everyone know there is hope for all to find peace.
Now Joseph and his wife Mary came to Bethlehem that night.
They found no place to bear the child, not a single room was inside.
And then they found a little nook in a stable all forlorn. And in a manger, cold and dark, Mary's little boy was born.
Art thou here, the angels sing, a king was born today.
And man will live forevermore
because of Christmas Day. Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day.
Oh, a moment still with rose aglow, all the bells rang out, there were tears of joy and laughter. People shouted, let everyone know there is hope for all to find peace. Sent your son to save us, oh my Lord. Your very self you gave us, oh my Lord. That sin may not enslave us and love may reign once more. Oh my Lord, when in the crypt they found him, oh my Lord. A golden halo crowned him, oh my Lord. They gathered all around him to see him and adore.
the valley, we will gather there. Helpless in our surrender, tomorrow the plow becomes the sword. Make us stronger in our danger.
That's Wishbone Ash from 1972, especially for the farmers, about the ploughshares. I wonder if anyone caught that little reference. And then before that was Boney M. with, it sounds like his guitar is still twanging away in the background there. They're a famous couple, weren't they, those two? Two lead guitarists in the same band. That's Wishbone Ash for you. Boney M, Mary's Boy Child, 1981. And at the start, you heard Blood, Sweat and Tears, God Bless the Child, from 1968. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And me, Tony Gosling. And Martin, we're going to go straight into the, have a listen to the farmers. But I've got a kind of bone to pick with you about this, because you don't like anybody inheriting things, do you?
I think that's over-exaggeration, Tony, but I think we do need strong inheritance taxes, yes. Why?
Well, we don't have them on corporations, do we?
No.
Corporations can pass things on and they don't get taxed.
You shouldn't tax profits or wages. You should tax economic rent, where people don't do anything and don't contribute to the social product, but they get paid stuff. You want to minimise economic rent. So, in other words, if you contribute to the social product, you should get something back.
Well, the farmers do, don't they? Farmers do.
Yes, insofar as they do. Mm. But of course, some people are pretending to be farmers and they don't, in fact.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely the point. The farmers are the people who are complaining about this. And before we actually hear from them, I thought it'd be quite useful to hear a bit about exactly what you're saying there, which is the people who are using farmland to make money from. And actually, the DEFRA committee, Department for Environment and Rural Affairs, Committee did have a meeting. In fact, maybe I'm not even sure if this RIP British Farming protest with the 600 plus tractors on Wednesday was actually framed around this meeting, but they were discussing this very issue that you're talking about. So I'm very glad to hear you bringing that up. The idea really being that there's something called business rollover relief, which rather than inheritance tax for farmers, the government could have tweaked to stop people taking advantage of this farmland tax break when they're not even farmers. People like Jeremy Clarkson, for example, although he is a farmer, he's just done it for that purpose.
In the House, actually, it is the time for the Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs Committee to be sitting today. And amongst the people talking to them, the witnesses in front of that committee, Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor at the Central Association of Agricultural Valuers. David Sturrock is a Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And Stuart Maggs is a partner at Howes Percival, LLP. Aaron Advani is the Director at the Centre for Analysis of Taxation as well. So the committee's having a look at this and the finance of farming. Here's the committee chair speaking right now.
But I get the suggestion that you think that's unlikely.
Yeah, the 20% tax rate for agriculture on its own would probably slow it slightly, but not as much as it could do if it had been 40% after some threshold. But other changes made at the same time mean that I think overall the net effect of the budget is probably not going to be that
significant.
Alistair Carmichael is the chair.
I just ask you about business rollover relief. I think there's a wide consensus that people that sell businesses avoid or defer capital gains tax by buying large tracts of land. They're sort of the people that most people feel should be dealt with. Could it not have been more effective and more targeted to use business rollover relief to actually tackle those people who were getting massive relief from capital gains tax? And wouldn't that have yielded more than actually using this mechanism, which allegedly risks bringing in practicing farmers who will be more troubled by the outcome?
Yeah, so for the benefit of the committee, in case not everyone follows all the tax details, it's the case that if you sell assets that are normally liable to capital gains tax, you purchase agricultural land, then you can not have to pay the capital gains tax up front. You said you get a relief while you're buying that. And a fairly standard planning strategy would be to sell those assets, get your large gain, purchase agricultural property, and if you hold that until you die, then you are relieved of inheritance tax, but also relieved then of the capital gains tax because you don't pay capital gains tax on assets you hold till death. So I think something that hasn't seemed to have been looked at this budget, but that certainly should be scrutinised because it causes this exact problem, is the fact that relief for any asset I'm selling, if I'm then using it to buy agricultural land, is a way in which I can avoid the capital gains and currently inheritance tax. And that creates demand for agricultural land from people who have no desire to farm the land but want to buy it because they're getting it from a tax minimisation perspective.
That would be a change that would not have the impact on those who are currently using the land for agricultural purposes.
That reform in itself wouldn't affect the people who are currently using the land for agricultural food production.
Why do you think that wouldn't have been looked at? Because it would have clearly have saved the government lots of challenges presentationally.
I can't really speculate on what the government does.
Okay, so that's a crucial little bit of the Environment Rural Affairs Select Committee, where they're talking about this thing called business rollover relief. The farmers, the experts in taxation, the valuers of farmland, there they are talking to MPs explaining, well, why didn't Rachel Reeves just get rid of this tax dodge, this way that people are avoiding? It's an avoidance, tax avoidance principle, where they're buying farmland even though they're not farmers and there's no intention of farmers to avoid paying tax.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? And of course, the other thing that strikes me that people have forgotten is things like grouse moors are treated as agricultural land. Are grouse moors agricultural? I think there's a big question mark.
Well, when was the last time you had a grouse for supper?
Well, I have never eaten them, actually. It's one of the few things I've not eaten.
Okay, right.
So, you didn't catch me that
I don't
one.
Like to hear you time. Saying all sorts of horrendous things that I'm thinking of having eaten, Martin, now. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to the farmers, because Farms Not Factories campaign were down on Wednesday, and they spoke to many of the farmers, the 600 or so tractors going around London and blocking Whitehall on Wednesday.
I'm Michael, we farm up in the Cambridgeshire Fens, fourth generation family farm, growing fruit, vegetables, flowers, cereal crops. Yeah, we're here really to protect the rural way of life, rural jobs. We want good quality British produce to put on the plate. We don't want imported food from around the world grown by corporations. And that's really why we're here. We're not here protesting against the tax per se, but given the way farms are structured and the very, very small margins they work to, you know, we cannot afford this tax. It is simple as that. UK agriculture will disappear very, very quickly under these taxes as they stand today. So we are asking for a softening, not necessarily a complete eradication, but a softening of what they're proposing. And that's why, you know, farmers from up and down the country are here today, because it really, really digs deep. There's people's, you know, health and livelihood, families are on the line. And, you know, this government needs to appreciate that this isn't about a money grab. This is about the whole sort of fabric of rural Britain up and down the country. So they need to go back, they need to listen to people who know more about how the countryside, how farms work, how small businesses work. Because this actually is not just about farms. This is about every small business up and down the country. You know, businesses that support farms, farms that support businesses, but even other businesses, you know, we're all going to be affected by these changes. Then you put on top of the national insurance changes, the pension changes, the grant systems that they've just cut and stopped. You know, it's all coming at once on the back of a very period of high inflation when we're already, you know, with our backs to the wall, frankly. And so we've got nothing to lose and everything to gain by being here fighting hard for our industry, our rural way of life, and everybody that's connected to it. That's the bottom line. I would like to think there isn't an ulterior motive, but when you see people like the Energy Secretary banding around doing what he's doing in the name of green energy and cheap energy, you know, you really do have to wonder, because these policies are flawed. They're not going to work. And, you know, I think, you know, either they're incredibly incompetent or there is a hidden motive, and, you know, they won't come clean on either. So we'll have to wait and see. Time will tell. And rural Britain, and well, I think the voting public will decide that in the end. But unfortunately, a lot of damage can be done in the meantime.
So my name's Harry Frederick. I am a farmer from Penshurst, which is in Kent, near Tunbridge. We have a few sheep, and then we grow crops, and we sell hay. And yeah, we left about 6:30 this morning on the A21, headed up, took about 2.5 hours to central London. Quite an experience, so I've not done that before. Not the easiest commute, so I think I'll get the train next time. But yeah, no, really good. Nice to see lots of people here supporting a good cause, you know, trying to back British farming and saying, you know, some of these new rules you're putting in, they will have unintended consequences of getting rid of a lot of British farmers and the small farmers, and their grounds are going to get bought up by these companies, corporations, and, you know, we're going to end up importing more food, and that's not always a good thing. You know, we need to look after our local food, so that's why I'm here.
I'm Liz Webster, and I'm the founder of Save British Farming, which we set up about 5 years ago, really to highlight the challenges that farming is facing, especially in light of Brexit changes. But not only that, for decades we've faced a real hammering down of prices because of the strength of the supermarkets. And today we're here because of the Labour government's latest budget, which is spelling the death knell of farming as we know it, which is something the British public really need to get awake to and try and join us to stop that happening. So there already are a lot more factories since in the last 5 years there's over 200 mega factories opened in Britain, and that will be the future, and that people will lose control, as we have no control of the water and the sewage, as we all know, that food will go down that same route, that you'll have no control over standards because it'll all be run by big corporations. This government promised that they wouldn't allow Tory trade deals to undercut farmers. They lied. They are actually aggressively trying to stop this judicial review by challenging their right to a cost-capping order, which means they're trying to bankrupt them so they can't do the judicial review. So it's absolutely essential that everybody gets behind feedback They need money. They're a non-government association. But that judicial review has got the potential to derail all of these really bad trade deals and get rid of this very unhealthy food that is coming in full of chemicals using methods that are banned here.
Hi, my name is Jeff Gibson. I'm one of the founders of Fairness for Farmers from Kent. I'm a mixed farmer from in between Canterbury and Dover, farming potatoes, free-range pork and a few cattle, all to mainly go through our farm shop.
Why are you here today?
I'm here because the threat towards British farming is massive. The people's food security is being put at risk by a petty, vengeful government that want farmers put down, want farmers destroyed, want farmers put out of business.
What's the ulterior motive? Why?
They want the land, they want cheap imports, they want anything that Bill Gates tells them to do, basically. Mass factory farming is absolutely horrific for the environment and it's horrific for the people that have to eat it. So any form of factory farm becomes more CO2 intensive. The more you can do things in the old-fashioned ways with a fewer amount of animals in an outdoor sustainable system, you're producing something that's a far higher quality, so you can have less of it. By having less of a quality product like British produce, you're eating food that's more sustainable and better for the environment.
Well, it's hard to see past some of the things. You've got Ed Miliband trying to cover the countryside in solar panels, and you've got Angela Rayner trying to smother the countryside in housing. It's strange, it's very odd timing that they want to take the power away from small individuals and get it more into something they can control more. But we won't go lying down. We will keep fighting. We will be here. We will keep coming back because we're not going to accept it. We don't lay down.
But it's not just you, it's us. What's going to happen to our food?
To your food. So what will happen is we'll just import more from around the world. And you'll get hormone-fed beef from Brazil that's fed antibiotics constantly. They're cutting down the Amazon rainforest to put massive feedlots in. And you'll just rely on food imports from America. You've got chlorine chicken, you've got again hormone fed beef from America, and it's just more and more. You see, we used to rely on Eastern Europe, now that's on fire, all at war. And what happens when there's a poor harvest in the rest of the world? Our food security is just going to be awful. I think food security is national security, and just taking away the expertise and knowledge from British farmers is just a disaster waiting to happen.
I'm Mick. I'm from Sevenoaks near Kent, in Kent. We're here today to demonstrate about the tax and all the other things that the government are doing to stop us farming, because they don't want us to farm, because my personal opinion is they want to buy the land to build houses on.
What do you think we're going to eat?
Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen about that? We're going to end up with cheap foreign imports. That's what's going to happen.
My name is Spencer Campbell. I'm 19 years old. I'm a farmer in South Suffolk. I farm everything across the country. I say I travel across the country, lambing, pumpkin harvesting is the latest one. And the reason I'm here really is because I'm scared for our future.
I'm Fergus Campbell. I'm from Kent, Ashford, little village called Pluckley. We've got about 250 breeding sheep, and I do a contracting business on the side that's mainly for family farms and big and that sort of thing. Came up this morning, had a lovely, glorious drive up and a lot of traffic.
So could you tell me why you wanted to come up here?
I feel that there's no future for anyone, and my daughter won't have anything to go on by the time she's like able to be in charge, and there won't be anything for anyone, and it'll all become a big factory farm.
My name's Tom, and we farm beef cattle just on the urban fringe, bottom south London, and I'm here because from what I can see, farming has no future in the UK unless what we do is valued and we receive some kind of sensible remuneration for the hours we put in, the risks we take and the time we spend. Previous government was hell-bent on Brexit and was prepared to make a deal, any deal, in order to prove that they could do so at the detriment to our industry. And this government is determined to bankrupt us by other means. So I'm not entirely sure it really matters what colour tie the politicians are wearing. But I do not feel that agriculture or food production is valued in this country. Certainly not by government.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm Peter Clements and I'm one of three brothers. We farm about 600 acres. And I'm here because I think the inheritance tax is going to change the face of British farming. And I think it's completely unthought through and completely wrong. And it's not only the farming side of things, but I think there are a lot of other things that this government is doing that are wrong, and I can't see them staying in power for very long. So anyway, I'm doing my bit to try and uphold British farming. I think it's ideologically driven. I think the amount of money that the inheritance tax is going to raise is not going to make any difference to the national economy. And they've made a whole lot of promises about income tax, which they haven't raised. And so they're trying to find the money elsewhere. And I think it's a very bad plan.
My name's Ed Carter Griffiths and I'm an agricultural contractor and calf rearer from North Kent. And I'm here today to try and change things, really. The government's been scrutinising British agriculture for far too long, and Keir Starmer has been the nail in the coffin for the job, really. There is far too many farms that are going to be pushed out by this new tax he's imposed, and I'm here to support everybody and try and change something about it. We were here last month on the march, and we're here again now to try and really show them that we're being serious, and it is going to seriously screw us over. I think they're trying to screw people for tax. I think they only see farms as tax evasion, which, as many know, is not the case. There is a lot of big people out there that are using it, but the likes of everybody here today are not those people. And the problem is you set the threshold far too low, and it's absolutely killing. It will kill everybody that's here today, pretty much. And the knock-on effect it will have, it will affect everybody, from the tractor manufacturers, everybody who works for them, people who work in supermarkets, people who buy food, everybody. And something needs to change, and something needs to change pretty rapidly.
So I'm reminded of our Stranglers song from last week, Something Better Change. I think, it's be wrong to characterise the farmers as just a bunch of rural Tories, particularly, Martin, there you've got people also complaining about Brexit, saying this is a part of the problem. And I found it quite interesting, almost so many of the people there, maybe it's just by coincidence, happened to be from Kent and Essex, which were the...
Well, you can't drive a tractor from north of Scotland.
Well, some actually did come a long, long way from Hampshire. You're being Scotland, facetious. I know you're being facetious. But from Kent and Essex, which was the 1381 Peasants' Revolt. I mean, farmers are potentially a revolutionary class. I know you sort of dismiss them, but they are.
Well, they were historically, but, that's not necessarily the case.
Well, you're
today.
Smirking there, aren't you? Why?
Well, I'm not. I'm just saying historically farmers or peasants were a revolutionary class. But then,
so they want to feel valued. Do you think that farmers should be valued?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm interested to hear about all of this.
Food security, is that valuable? It's quite important.
Yes, it is. But ultimately, if we're going to farm in Britain, and I think we should, you've got to recognise that in international terms, it's not viable. It is cheaper to buy stuff in from elsewhere. It always has been.
So it was always cheaper to sack all the British miners and to import coal from mines where the conditions were absolutely diabolical and appalling.
The conditions are different in Colombia, where most of our coal comes from. They're massively mechanised.
They're horrific.
Well, they're massively mechanised. We've had some of their trade union people over here. What the problem with it is it's very environmentally destructive, and the local farming communities.
So it's okay to it's okay to import the coal. It's okay to import the food.
Listen, I'm not Tony. I'm a socialist. I believe in intervention in markets. I believe in intervening in the market to protect farmers. But in that case, we're going to have to find the money to protect them with, which means we've got to take the money off landowners.
No, we've got to take the money. How about taking the money off the supermarkets?
We could nationalise the supermarkets, or we could give the cooperative shops.
We could ensure
at one stage we're taking over the whole of retail in this country in the 1920s. They were taking the whole lot of it over, and we could have had a completely cooperativised system, but we haven't got one. Because people like Shirley Porter and Tesco and all of these other people, they're big funders of the of the
Tesco
Tory party.
Also, we're in range. The boss of Tesco, is it Leahy, I think? He was the guy that arranged the hostile takeover of Morrison's, which was the only large supermarket chain which had direct deals with between farmers and their local supermarkets. That's gone now. And all of this food is coming through the big livestock meat processors, etc. And of course, there's massive price fixing going on. You see the same packets in every kind of supermarket nowadays. So the supermarkets are largely to blame for a lot of this, and several of them mentioned them. But I mean, this whole business of food security, it's like the government really doesn't care anywhere near as much about us getting decent, good quality, locally grown food. What they really care about is the profits of the big corporations who are part of the food chain and actually controlling that food chain right the way down from the supermarket, from the consumer, all the way through the distribution systems to the very growing of the food in the first place. This is a monopolistic, fascistic tradition the Rockefellers pioneered called vertical integration. And that's what they want to be able to price fix right the way from start to finish of all of the food that we eat.
They certainly do. The corporations, that is their plan. There's no doubt about it. The Labour government, on the other hand, is simply trying to balance the books. And they could have just said, we're going to raise income tax or capital gains tax. But they said they weren't going to do that. So they're now scrabbling around behind the sofa to get the money from somewhere.
So what about this business rollover relief? Why didn't they do that instead?
Well, that's a very interesting...
Isn't that funny, isn't it?
That's a very interesting point. Now, what I would hope, what I would imagine the farmers are looking for is for the government to change its mind about this law. Because it hasn't been passed yet. Now... You're either there to...
It's coming in April, isn't it?
Yes, okay, but the point is it's got... You know, the point of protesting is because you want them to change it.
Yeah.
Now, lots of people will not understand the ins and outs of this issue unless it's explained to them.
Yeah, well, we've been doing that.
Well, we're doing our best.
We're doing quite a good job, actually, hearing those... There was something like 10 farmers we heard from there, each of whom has got a slightly different perspective.
Yes.
And I think listening to them, you get a pretty damn good idea.
So
let's have a listen now, before you say anything else, to Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, talking on this very subject this week when he was quizzed about the farmers.
Despite their show of muscle last month, the government still appears unmoved. Arsa, the Prime Minister, is concerned that farmers might get more militant and restrict food supplies in protest. Downing Street said that they've been very clear they're not going to change course on this policy. Last month, Keir Starmer insisted only a small minority of farmers will lose out.
It's a small number of cases, and it's payable over 10 years. But I would also just add this. I grew up, obviously, in a rural area, and I know that in rural areas, in farming communities, they need good hospitals, they need good schools, and they need houses that people can afford.
Well, maybe we can take some of that money from wealthy people rather than farmers on inheritance. I mean, there's a lot of people have been comparing this to you know, a large house, like a £3 million mansion. Actually, in London, £3 million doesn't buy you a mansion these days. So as house price and land inflation, especially since land is now being used as a tax dodge, and lots of people are putting their money into land in order to avoid paying capital gains tax and this sort of thing. So the thresholds of the inheritance tax, Martin, are being forced up, aren't they, all the time, into this area. So more and more thousands and, you know, coming towards tens of thousands of people are having to pay inheritance tax on something that, you know, most of us would say, well, why are they having to pay it? They're not wealthy.
Well, I mean, what you mean is that people are falling into inheritance tax who previously didn't because of the way the, you know,
an asset bubble. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we should. I mean, you don't really want asset bubbles. I mean, that's the issue.
Well, that's all we do now, isn't it?
Well, that's all we do in this country. That's right.
Seems to be, yeah.
And of course, the problem is that the fundamentals of the British economy have been ruined over many years, and we're now having to. I mean, the economy, for example, shrank in October, which they weren't expecting, and I think that's the beginning of a major recession. Now, if there's a major recession, marginal farmers will be pulsed out of work.
Well, with the Labour government, surely the super rich who made so much out of COVID and are doing so well through all this lobbying, this time, surely, for Rachel Reeves to start grabbing a few quid off them.
Yes, but the point is that they made in their manifesto, and of course they got a lot of money from the super rich. You know, it's not the trade unions that fund the Labour Party anymore. The super rich and the supermarkets and the land developers, they're the ones providing the money for the party.
The speculators. Yeah.
And of course, they made it clear that they're not Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and we're not going to soak the rich. So if you're not going to soak the rich, you've got to balance the books. You don't have to balance the books, but if you're going to balance the books, you've got to find the money somewhere.
Big investors behind many of the these factory farms, the massive greenhouses, several acre greenhouses that I was doing a Rupert the Bear thing on Wednesday, having a good old look at. These are automated greenhouses surrounded by solar farms, so the whole thing is just all automatic, and there is rather interesting smell of skunk cannabis as I was walking past there on Wednesday. But these kind of businesses, plus the speculators, are being funded by BlackRock, including, we're talking about here, about these carbon offset companies. And so I came across this interesting little clip about saying BlackRock don't want to be in the news. So let's have a quick listen to that.
Do you have any thoughts on the Ukraine-Russia war?
Yeah. Ukraine is good for business. You know, right? We don't want the conflict to end.
Why?
We don't want the conflict to end as a country. The longer this goes on, the weaker Russia is. I'll give an example. Russia blows up Ukraine's grain silos. Price of wheat's gonna go mad up. So what are you gonna do if you're a trading firm? The moment that news hits, within a millisecond, you're gonna pump trades into whoever the wheat suppliers are, into their stocks. Within an hour or two, that stock goes up, and then you sell, and you just made, I don't know, however many mil.
Why would a news channel promote a side and war?
Because it's also good for business too. I mean, what's news? News, right? What does news feed on? They feed on strategy, they feed on up events. That's what people like to watch. So when it happens, it's good business. More viewers. When nothing's happening, watch news. I don't watch news.
They're all pushing like the same talking point. Like, you generally, when you look at news, like,
it's propaganda. The Ukrainian economy is tied very largely to the wheat market, global wheat market. This is fantastic if you're trading. Volatility creates opportunity to make profit. War is real f***ing good for business. It's exciting when shit goes wrong, right?
Serge also speaks on BlackRock-influenced news and even gave our journalists some tips.
They don't want people to talk about them. They don't want to be anywhere on the radar.
Why not?
I don't know, but I suspect it's probably because it's easier to do things when people aren't thinking about it.
It's easier to do things when you're BlackRock, when people aren't thinking about it, Martin. That guy's name's Serge. Sorry, I don't know who the undercover reporter was. Great little job she's doing there. And also exposing the purpose of war is it brings in all this volatility into these big international markets. And there is he's saying, oh, a millisecond after you hear this piece of news, you buy loads of the a particular stock of Cargill's or some big grain company, and then you find just a few days later you can sell it at a massive profit.
Yeah,
it's gambling.
It's
isn't it?
Called forestalling and ingrating in the Middle Ages. I mean, this manipulation of grain markets by Cargill in particular has been going on for years, and it's part of US war fighting strategy. I mean, Kissinger said years ago, you know, you control the oil and you can control the governments. If you control the food supply, you control the people. And, of course, that's the whole purpose of subsidised. Putin was talking about this the other day. Subsidised Western farm production, whether it's US or EU and Britain, basically ruins the market for everybody else. And of course they gradually take over markets in the developing world, where of course they're much more dependent on agriculture than we are. And you know, you eventually get a situation where many countries like Egypt, for example, Syria wasn't in that position, but it's been put into that position. But Egypt requires loads and loads of cheap grain coming in, subsidised by the Americans, and that's what underpins America's control of Egypt. Because, of course, at any point they can cut that off and put everybody, you know, starve them as they're being starved in Gaza.
Yep, all sorts of means for the international mafia to control countries through these sort of geopolitical shenanigans. Also, interesting bit of news this week, Robert Kennedy is pushing for one of his family members to take a post of the deputy director of the CIA, Martin, so they can get to the bottom of who killed JFK. This is starting to get interesting, isn't it?
It is. We'll have to see how it plays out, though, because, of course, as we know, Trump ain't in charge yet, and there's all sorts of things happening.
No, he's talking about... Well, he's already sacked the boss of the FBI, hasn't he?
Yes.
The boss of the FBI is moving out of the way. Trump's got his man ready to go.
Yeah, but we were talking earlier about how... I can't remember who was saying this... about how, you know, the president doesn't really... it was Assad, wasn't it, who was saying it? You know, we realise that the president of the US doesn't really control it. You know,
anyway,
we all know that, don't we?
We're still supposedly talking about farmers, just about, because the interest for me is the land in Ukraine is becoming pretty obvious that the idea is to buy up that land so that big US corporations, big multinational from the West can take the profits from it, from growing grain, etc. A bit more vertical integration, of course, by the international food control system. The same sort of thing going on here. So there was a question about this at Prime Minister's Questions this week as well, about the farmer protest. I was rather disgusted and amazed, but of course you don't get that these days when the political parties are in such a total mess, as Dominic Cummings described in his long talk, which was on our show page last week, the full version of that. But they did bring up the farming protest outside the RIP British Farming, with the 600-plus tractors going around Whitehall, Trafalgar Square in central London, at PMQs.
Jerome Bayou.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr Speaker, losing a farm is not like losing any other business. Yeah. It can't come back. Yeah. Now, those are the words of the Prime Minister, those that he said to the NFU in order to get their votes. Yeah. So can the Prime Minister understand why farmers in Broughton and Fakenham and around the country now think that his administration is duplicitous?
Mr. Speaker, I think everybody welcomes the £5 billion over the next 2 years that we put in the budget to... Well, they shake their heads. I'm afraid they do. £350 million in the last week alone, compared with the £300 million underspend by the last government. On the threshold, as he well knows, in an ordinary family case, the threshold is £3 million, and that means the vast majority of farmers will be unaffected.
So that's Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions. And I think we'll round up, Martin, and you can give your thoughts after you've heard this, with what is a sort of threat, really, from the farmers, saying, look, unless you do something about this and cancel this inheritance tax rise, well, let's have a listen to one of the organisers of Wednesday's RIP British Farming protest.
Who's going to listen this time, Jeff?
No, not in the slightest. This is going to have to escalate. This is going to have to go to all major roads, ports, oil refineries. This is a warning shot for the government today. This is how much the anger is boiling over amongst farmers. If he doesn't listen, we won't just go away. We're not going to just lay down and take this.
So what do you reckon to that? Oil refineries find loads of tractors in the way. Never mind the old sort of environmental protesters with their hands handcuffed together. A tractor is a rather more difficult thing to shift, isn't it?
Well, if you remember, Farmers for Action many years ago did this during the last Labour government, didn't they? Because they were unhappy with it was to do with the fuel prices, wasn't it, that they were protesting? Well, I mean, this stuff is normal. I mean, if you see what's happening across Europe, I mean, Polish farmers have been blockading the border with Ukraine to prevent cheap Ukrainian grain from flooding into their market because it's wiping them out. And, you know, the Ukrainians have been allowed to sell their stuff into the European Union market and there are knock-on effects on us, even though they're not in the European Union. And, you know, their costs are much lower than farmers in the European Union, particularly Polish farmers, who are often very small farmers, smaller than they are here. I mean, they're basically peasants rather than farmers, if you like, if you know what I mean.
Well, like a market gardener or a smallholder. I mean, that we used to have, when I was growing up, we had market gardens, small holdings all around.
Yeah, well,
the South East London fringe, and say if you're on your way to your auntie's, you could just pop in and get a bit of spinach, some carrots that were grown right under your feet.
Yes, well, I mean, in Poland, they've got one of the largest surviving peasantries in Europe, so that they were the people who'd always farmed the land, and that used to be owned by the Schlacht of the landowners before the war.
What's happened
after the
here
war,
in Britain,
it was all given by the communists
but what's
to
happened
the
here in Britain is that they've made small holdings, they've made market gardens unviable. They've just made, unless you're an actual owner occupier and you're right in where the market is, so in other words you've got plenty of cars driving past, they will come in and use your farm shop or whatever, it's just impossible for these small institutions to survive. They've made it so that something like between 300 and 500 acres is an absolute minimum. If you've got less than that, then you may as well just sell your land off to some other farmer, or maybe to someone who's trying to avoid paying capital gains tax.
Yeah, well, I mean, if what you've got to do, if in my view, in agricultural policy, you've got to decide what you want. And as I said, years ago, I spoke to French farmers when I was at a conference, and they were saying, well, what we want is subsidy per working farmer. We don't want to be creating wine lakes and butter mountains and all the rest of it. What we want is to be subsidised to do what we're doing. And of course, in Poland and France, you've still got quite a lot of small farmers. They're quite politically powerful, and they can say, well, we want policies which are going to protect our way of life. Now, if that's what we're about doing, then we've got to focus on that and do that. The problem with the British attitude towards the agricultural sector going back to the 18th, 19th century is we want the minimum number of people working in farming. We want it run as a maximum efficiency. And of course, we used to bring in all of our foodstuffs from the empire. So we get our lamb from New Zealand, we get our beef from Argentina, we get our wheat from Canada,
but
where it can
right
be produced far
that,
more cheaply.
Right the way through that, we supported British farmers. Now it seems that we're much more interested in the World Economic Forum, that Parliament is a bit of a boring place where you get irritating people asking awkward questions. Much easier to go and sit down with a bunch of bigwigs up at Davos on the top of the Swiss mountains and say, right, we can carve it up for you. Just tell us what you want us to do, Mr. BlackRock. And that's what our Prime Minister now seems to be doing.
Well, I mean, if you changing the subject slightly, this is idea of building loads and loads of houses on greenbelt land. Now, how I was thinking about this earlier, how is building loads of Barrett homes on greenbelt land going to house the homeless in Bristol? Because none of the people who are homeless can afford to buy any of those houses.
Well, they'll
so
be
just
go, they'll
increasing
go into
the supply
have to go into
of unaffordable
debt.
Houses.
They have to go into debt.
Well,
anyone that's not for the homeless, no. This is for people who are desperately trying to get started on the housing ladder. That's what those so-called unaffordable homes are for. They're little boxes, by the way, far smaller than the old council houses used
to
be.
So what you're doing is you're trying to bribe people to vote Labour because we're going to get you on the housing ladder. Now, what Jeremy Corbyn was opposing is we need to build loads of council houses.
This is what the Labour Party used to do. Because
well,
of
know,
the current people running the Labour Party.
No, yeah, that's right. But the current people running the Labour Party are Blair 2. It's absolutely reheated third way stuff. We are basically going to go with big business. The developers are very happy because they're going to be given a free ride. And of course, I cannot see the point. We've got a housing crisis in this country, but building loads of Barrett homes to try and get potential Tory voters to vote Labour is going to do nothing for all these families
It's actually doing nothing for anybody because what it's doing is it's a very low quality housing. Far way overpriced because of the way the housing bubble works out, and it's enslaving people in a ridiculously overpriced little pigeonhole boxes. Absolutely vile little places.
So why aren't they doing the obvious thing?
They look so ugly.
Why aren't they doing the obvious thing, which is building council houses on brownfield sites?
Because there's no one lobbying for it, Martin, but the house builders and the land speculators and the BlackRocks of this world are lobbying.
Now, who do you think funds the Labour Party these days? World do you think it's the trade unions? Or do you think it's the developers?
Forum. And people making all sorts of vast amount. I mean, who was
the
that?
Housing developers were very, very prominent at the Labour Party conference. That's why they're doing this.
The speculators. Yeah. Anyway, so before we have our final item on the Friday the 13th theme, there is also a attack going on free software. That is to say Linux. Now, as we're sitting here, I've got a computer which is running Linux, and so has Dave. So this is called free software. It's also collaboratively put together. It's what's actually called open source software. In other words, you know what it's doing. Closed source software like Microsoft Windows, only Bill Gates, or not, no longer Bill Gates, but Microsoft and their people know exactly what it's doing. It can be all sorts of nice little backdoors from GCHQ and the NSA right into there. Maybe before we hear this, Martin, I remember when we were doing all the 9/11 stuff back in the noughties, you and I, there was a fascinating aspect to this, which was that even the people at the North American Air Defense centers, that is to say the people who are in charge of running the Air Force, basically, and the defense of the United States, they were saying to each other, is this real world or is it exercise? Because blips were appearing on their radar screens on their nice Windows computers that didn't actually appear to be real aircraft at all.
Well, that's because it was an exercise, and therefore it was going to be run on the computers. These are the computers which are actually the air defence. So when they're seeing a blip, we're in this so-called war game where we've got these people flying planes around, and then suddenly say, well, it's not a war game, it's actually happening. And of course, then you really don't know what that blip is. Is it the blip that the guys put in the computer as part of the war game?
Or they were told that the exercise was finished because there was a real emergency.
Well, that's why they said that stuff.
So this is backdoors into MS-DOS and then Windows.
Yes, I know, but I mean, the point is that the computers were being used in a computer simulation of an attack, and then a real attack happened, okay? And, of course, that's often, as you know, how these things are done.
Oh, it is.
Can I just make an interesting point, which I'll forget if you don't let me make it. Larry Johnson, who we've had on this show, the ex-CIA guy, who's done this very interesting thing, is at one stage, the various tech companies were protecting their software from being hacked, and the NSA approached them and said, we need to open it up so that we can see what's going on. And they went along with it and made backdoors into all their software. Guess what? The Chinese have got into all of it, because once you opened it up, they could just get in and get everything.
Oh, it's handy.
So that's what they've done.
Rather handy for Fujitsu and people like that to get into these things, isn't it?
If I was the Chinese intelligence service and you put a back door into everything, well, we're just going to go through that back
door. Maybe we should just go back to old-fashioned bits of paper.
Well, that's actually the Taliban drove the Western forces out of Afghanistan by doing exactly that. Just stick to word of mouth and personal networks.
So if you go back to 1975, you'll find there was a BBC children's TV series called The Changes. The Changes, which was actually filmed here by the BBC and produced here in Bristol by Anna Holm, that programme was all about technology. To me, this is acceleration, accelerationism. The idea that everything will become computerized and technofied is a trap. And in that series, it's a brilliant, it was made for children's television. I can remember rushing home from school to see it back in 75, because it was absolutely gripping. It was all about how people sort of suddenly decided, some sort of innate force within them, that they were going to smash up and destroy all technology. That is to say, anything to do with electricity, radios. So the first thing to to go was the television. So putting a great big baseball bat basically through the TV in the house, and it was considered to be quite chilling, based on a book by Peter Dickinson. But anyway, the modern day version, I suppose, is this attempt by the Microsofts of this world, the tech giants, to close down this whole idea of free software and open source software.
Richard Stallman will never budge an inch. So what you have to do, if you really want to change the free software definition and just free software in general, you have to get rid of Richard Stallman. And that's really what the whole point of this website was. I just wish they would have been honest up front with us instead of, you know, trying to create this document, this weird document that somehow insinuates Richard Stallman as some kind of sexual predator, which he absolutely is not. But here's the thing. If this group of individuals, they need more than just one seat on a board of directors to really change things, you can't just get rid of Richard Stallman. So you know what they recommend? They recommend the following four people that are on the board of directors. You guys also need to go along with Richard, right? You guys have to go. And the reason you have to go, I don't know. They don't really, like, they basically say you have to go because maybe you enabled Richard in some way, because I guess you're a part of the Free Software Foundation. It's very weird. I don't know why these four individuals are responsible for anything Richard Stallman has ever said or any action Richard Stallman has ever taken. Even if Richard did do some things that might have been reprehensible and deserve Richard being removed from the Free Software Foundation, what the hell does that have to do with any of these people? Well, all of these people, they're part of the Free Software Foundation board of directors, and they probably, like Richard, believe in free software completely and the four freedoms completely. They would never want to see a change in the free software definition. So you know what? We're going to lump you in with Richard, even though you have nothing to do at all with anything that's been said on this webpage as far as the Stallman report. We're just going to go ahead and demand right now, you guys go too. Basically, there's probably like half a dozen people that's part of this group behind the Stallman report. They want those seats. So they need a certain number of people gone from the Free Software Foundation board of directors so they can all take the seats and then take control of the Free Software Foundation and then lead it in a totally different direction. Now, the Free Software Foundation is very heavily linked with the GNU Project, which Richard also found, right? Richard founded the Free Software Foundation and the GNU Project. Richard still leads the GNU Project, right? And the GNU Project is very important because all of the GNU software, anything that's GNU software, they sign over the rights to their software to the GNU Project. So who controls all of that software? Who controls all the licensing behind that software? Well, it's the guy that leads the GNU Project, Richard Stallman, right? He's the one that basically controls the licensing for everything. You know, he demands everything to be GPL software, right? And if, again, if you're wanting to change free software, you really want to change the GPL, or you want to get rid of the GPL, you want to substitute other things for the GPL. So you don't just need to take control of the Free Software Foundation. You need to take control of the GNU Project as well. And they demand that Richard Stallman be removed from the GNU Project as well. That's pretty obvious, right? It doesn't take very much brain power to realize the motivations behind this entire report. And if you've been paying attention for the last few years, you can come up with this small group of individuals that almost certainly are behind the Stallman report, because we've seen all of this before.
So that's a report there on the a guy called Richard Stallman, who's obviously quite a key figure in creating these forms of alternatives to Windows, and also this thing in the GNU project being... hang on, they're saying he's a paedophile. They're saying all sorts of things about this poor chap. He's also, as we hear from last year on the Register, he has cancer now. He's now in his 70s. You know, this idea, Martin, is quite important, isn't it? That closed source software people might wish to shut down the open source ability of people like Linux and Red Hat to compete with Windows. It's actually quite, I mean, this computer works okay. I mean, it's pretty good. Okay, it doesn't do everything that Windows will do, and a lot of the software for Windows is not available for Linux, but it does, you know, everything that we want it to do here. For example, you can get all of the main well-known bits of apps. You can get Linux versions of them. I can remember back in, gosh, this is a long time ago, it might even be the 1990s, this thing called the Halloween Memo, where Microsoft was caught saying, right, well, and it was on a Halloween that they'd sent this memo around, saying we're going to have to destroy open source software completely because it has the ability, by bringing in people, volunteers for free from all around the world to help develop it, we might not be able to beat it as a private corporation.
Well, one would like to think that was so. And I think it's... I'm wondering, how can they destroy private software, Linux software?
Well, we've just been hearing from that guy. They're trying to control the board, the company that's now running it. The idea is to get Stallman and other people
then just turn it into...
a fake version of
software.
Well, not necessarily straight away, but what you do is you gain, the Microsoft types will be paying people to try and infiltrate it and gain control of the board that controls the software.
Well, that's the way Microsoft have always operated, isn't it? They're going for monopoly with everything. And of course, Dave can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the Chinese use Windows at all, do they? They use Linux. Red Hat, they used to call it, didn't they?
Yeah, they've got their own version of Linux now.
Yeah, so in other words, for military reasons, the non-West doesn't use Western software.
And we...
They've worked out why not.
By the way, folks, we don't use it here in this studio, you'll be very pleased to hear, and it all works. So that, no wonder Microsoft and people like that want to destroy it. Anyway, finally, this evening, Friday the 13th, one of my favourite days, is when the Knights Templar were arrested by Philip the Fair, the French king, who had... The story goes that in 1307 that he had a visit from a foreign dignitary, a prince, a king, or an ambassador or somebody, and he said, oh yes, I've got one of my amazing jewels that is very much like your one, which is in my treasury, and I will come and show you that. And so they went off in the horse and carriage, I suppose it would have been in those days, off to the treasury, which was guarded by the Knights Templar. He turned up with this foreign dignitary, and the guard on the gate said, it's more than my job's worth, mate, to let you in here. And the king was absolutely wild that the Templars had had the audacity to stop him getting into his own treasury. And so he started to believe some of the rumours that were told about the Templars and their satanic rites of various sorts. And the rest is history. He got them all arrested. And that was the beginning of the end of the Templars. They got wind of a lot of this stuff, and they fled from La Rochelle in France up to Edinburgh. That's one of the stories. I mean, it's all a little bit mysterious. And then they re-emerged decades or a long time later as Freemasonry, the idea of the lodge being a place where you can secretly hide if you're a Templar. So anyway, let's have a listen now to something which is much more up-to-date, much more relevant, which is this thing called P2. Now, Martin, the P2 scandal was a Masonic lodge over in Italy run by a fascist, a notorious fascist, Licio Gelli, who died a couple of years ago. But they were running the country from behind the scenes, funded by the Americans, weren't they?
Yes, P2 stands for Propaganda Due, which was the name of the lodge. And it wasn't even a regular Freemasonry lodge. I mean, it's just, people didn't know it existed.
They were like the Uber Masons
kind of thing. Yes, that's right. I mean, they used that as the way in which they coordinated between people like Agnelli, who was the head of Fiat, the military and all the rest of it. And this is what was behind Gladio, the Strategia di Tensione.
Well, Gladio being the bombing of Italian citizens and blaming it on the affiliates of the Russians.
Well, it wasn't the Russians necessarily. What it was doing was creating different, the Red Brigades were not directly controlled by the Russians. There was no pretense that they were, but they were being manipulated by SISMI, which is the intelligence services. And of course, Philip Whitehead had written a book about it years ago, said, well, the left-wing terrorists were marionettes and the right-wing terrorists were puppets.
Everyone is not familiar with Gladio, Alan Frankovich's three-part series for Time Watch, which went out in 1992, I think it was, or 93.
93.
on the BBC was absolutely brilliant and explosive stuff, explaining that the CIA, MI6 and P2 in Italy had been going around Europe just blowing people up and trying to blame these left-wing groups, some of which I know you were quite friendly with at the time.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's not just left-wing or right-wing. What they do is they create chaos, which, of course, is exactly the model behind the Islamist terrorism.
But it was relevant for Italy, wasn't it? Because it was a potential communist being brought into the government.
Well, that's right. I mean, Aldo Moro was the head of the Christian Democrat Party, and he was a prime minister. He set off for the parliament to invite Enrico Berlinguer, who's the head of the Communist Party, into the government. So it would have been a coalition government between Christian Democrats and communists, because they were the two biggest parties. But he never got there. Kidnapped by the Red Brigades, held for 70
days. Well, hang on, kidnapped by P2.
Kidnapped by T2, because it wasn't, in fact, the Red Brigades. But Franceschino and the other guy's name I've forgotten now, Renato Curcio, they were interviewed in the film. Because they were arrested just before the kidnap, and they were flabbergasted because they'd set up the Red Brigades, and then suddenly they were arrested, and then the Red Brigades, which wasn't them, Mario Moretti took over, and he was an agent.
This is a basically...
And of course, it was actually the state that kidnapped...
This is a
to prevent him doing what he was doing.
A secret Masonic parallel government, basically, involving the police, the army, the media, and all sorts of elite institutions
across the fascist mafia, the CIA fascist mafia nexus.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's have a listen to a lovely guy. His name is Martin Short. Died a couple of years ago, sadly. But I got to know him, and he wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood, which is absolutely brilliant insight into some of the key aspects of how Freemasonry is completely corrosive here in the West. And that's what we'll end with tonight. An extract from Martin's it's called The Brotherhood, and it's a whole, I think it's like 6 hours or something altogether, of a series he made after he published Inside the Brotherhood for ITV back in the 1980s. So let's have a listen now to his section on P2, a hidden parallel government in Italy, which seems to be the MO now in the West.
In a police raid on the properties of an obscure mattress manufacturer in Arezzo, Tuscany. His name was Licio Gelli. The police seized thousands of documents relating to a Masonic lodge called P2, which almost no one outside Freemasonry knew anything about. What shocked the police were the names on a list of 980 members. There were dozens of leading Italian businessmen and industrialists, and the police chiefs of Italy's four biggest cities, a total of 43 MPs, including the Ministers of Justice and Foreign Trade. There were 51 generals and admirals, and the heads of all Italy's secret services. Together, these men operated like a private government, manipulating one of Europe's biggest democracies. Leading bankers like Calvi completed the list.
When the Italian government gave out publicly the list of the P2, we were astonished. It was like discovering that Italian democracy was something else from what we had always believed. We saw that there was another something going on underneath the surface of events. And so we asked ourselves why.
The answer goes back to a bitter struggle between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in Italy, which has lasted ever since English gentlemen and sea captains introduced the Brotherhood here in the 1730s. The Church soon branded Freemasonry the work of the devil and excommunicated all Catholic Masons. Italian Freemasonry turned anti-Catholic and revolutionary and went underground. It has had a clandestine and persecuted history ever since. The Grand Orient is Italian Freemasonry's ruling body.
Contrary to what happens in England and America, where the state not only tolerates Freemasonry, but recognizes it, here state and church don't recognize it, but even condemn it without knowing it.
In 1926, Italy's dictator Mussolini banned Freemasonry. After World War II, it was made legal again, and an old secret elite lodge was reborn as Propaganda Due, or P2. This failed to recruit many members, until the Grand Master at the time asked Licio Gelli to take over in 1970. Gelli immediately set about changing the character of P2. Tonight, he speaks out in defense of his lodge.
Militavano nella P2 i migliori uomini.
Inside the P2 lodge, we had the top men Italy had in all fields, in the world of politics, in diplomacy, the top men from industry, the press, the law, and the civil service. They were all the very best. By joining P2, they wanted peace and tranquility within the lodge, so that they could all contribute in their own fields to the betterment of society.
L'uno sia l'altro per poter migliorare la società.
Gelli initiated his P2 elite in a suite in Rome's Excelsior Hotel, not in a Masonic temple. It never met like a conventional lodge. Instead, select groups of members plotted to control the state, as agendas seized at Gelli's premises revealed.
The political and economic situation of Italy, the threat of the Italian Communist Party, aiming at the conquest of power, the spread of immorality, indiscipline, relationships with the Italian state.
We were striving for the improvement of society, to make a contribution, to safeguard the democratic institutions of our country. This was P2.
But in the 1930s and 40s, when Mussolini ruled Italy, Gelli was a dedicated fascist, and he's never been a friend of democracy. After the war, he fled to South America. He returned in the 1960s, when he was wealthy, respectable, and an ideal Masonic recruit.
I felt Masonry was the university where one went to learn rules of right and wrong and graduated with a degree in morals, sound principles, and ethics. These were the only reasons I joined the Masons, and I'd join them again. I have been a Mason, I am a Mason, and I shall behave all my life as a Mason.
He's a man that likes darkness, he's a man that likes intrigue, he's a man that says that like democracy but has a very strange idea of democracy. He comes from the extreme right, I don't think he has ever left that position. His friends are still the same fascists that he met with during the war.
After the raid on Gelli's villa and the exposure of P2, it became clear that the main aim of the lodge was to subvert democracy. An exhaustive parliamentary inquiry found that P2 was a state within a state, a cell of extreme right wingers bent on maintaining power by ruthless means. For example, in 1978, Italy's Christian Democrat Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, favoured bringing the communists into government in a plan known as the Historic Compromise. But then, Moro's car was ambushed and he was kidnapped by left-wing terrorists. Evidence which later emerged suggested that the longer Moro was held captive, the better it suited the P2 Masons who headed the secret services.
Chi avrebbe dovuto trovare Aldo Moro?
A committee drawn up from the staff of the Interior Ministry was put in charge of finding Moro. They were nearly all P2 men. Later, I was on the Moro inquiry. I read all the documents, the few there were from that committee, and I must say, dispassionately, that they had no intention of finding Moro. To leave Moro in the hands of the terrorists, to let the situation rot, was a sure way to make sure that the historic compromise did not come to fruition.
Three months after Moro's kidnap, he was found dead in the boot of a car. His body bore the marks of repeated torture. But Italy's body politic had also been mutilated, and the communists have been shut out of government ever since. According to the Italian Parliament's report, P2 members, in a black propaganda campaign, also planned or backed grotesque acts of terror, including one of Europe's worst terrorist crimes. In 1980, a bomb blew up in Bologna station, killing 85 people. To discredit the communists, This was made to look like an act of left-wing terror, but it was committed by fascists.
The massacre, according to the High Court of Bologna, was committed by some subversive neo-fascist individuals. But it's also a fact that a near-permanent contact was established between right-wing subversive elements, the P2 Lodge, and the men of P2.
Today, under the nervous protection of armed police, Gelli is at liberty in his magnificent home in Tuscany. While not directly involved in the Bologna bombing, this year he was convicted of covering the bomber's tracks and given a 10-year jail sentence. However, the terms of his earlier extradition from Switzerland mean he will never go to jail for the crime.
So that's the lovely Martin Short, his big fat, it must be at least an inch and a half, probably 2 inches thick book, Inside the Brotherhood, is absolutely the reason it's so good is because, and we'll be hearing, I think, maybe next week, something to do with the origin of Martin and his work around Freemasonry, is because there was a guy called Stephen Knight, and he wrote a book in the 1980s called Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution, which linked the whole Jack the Ripper case back to Freemasonry and the royal family. Very interesting. And he got this stuff by word of mouth through one of the families of the people who'd known a famous painter at the time, who's now still well recognised, a guy called Walter Sickert. And he'd lived very close to, and his artist studio was very close to where this was all going on. So he was a kind of centre of gossip for what was really going on. And of course, he was sworn to secrecy. There's no way he's going to go and talk about what he really knows, because he'll lose his career, possibly his life as well. He's trusted by these wealthy people. And so Stephen wrote this book, Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. And then mysteriously died he wrote another book called The Brotherhood, because he got loads of information about Freemasonry from disgruntled Freemasons and ex-Freemasons, and he wrote The Brotherhood. But anyway, Stephen then died in the late 1980s, and all of the papers that he had and the other stuff that had come in from writing The Brotherhood was given to Martin Short, who wrote what is an actually amazing compilation of information about the shenanigans of Freemasonry in Britain, which of course is many see as a sort of home of world Freemasonry, and well worth also mentioning the book called Born in Blood, The Lost Secrets of Freemasonry by John J. Robinson. That book explains very clearly, the best one I've ever seen, the connection between the Knights Templar and the Freemasons. Very, very good and absolute de rigueur for anybody who's interested in this subject. And the reason, in a way, this is still extremely relevant is because the Freemasonic rituals, entered apprentice, fellow craft, master mason, the first three degrees. I'm not quite sure about all the rest of them, but they all involve, what is it? They all involve a ritual, swearing of a blood oath to keep the secrets, and all around the rebuilding of Solomon's temple, back, of course, in Jerusalem. And so this is all linked up with Christian Zionism and the genocide we're seeing in Gaza. That's why this is an interesting subject. These secret societies are absolutely fascinating. So the book is Born in Blood, The Lost Secrets of Freemasonry. I also put a link up to Martin Short's long documentary and his book, Inside the Brotherhood, and the ITV documentary, The Brotherhood. So hopefully, for anyone that's interested in this sort of stuff, on Friday the 13th, then you will, you can link it all right, literally, right back to the present day, which is one of the things I find absolutely fascinating about all of this. And so that is it for today. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, of course, to Susan Lindau, who we're hoping very much to have. She has promised to come on the show before the Trump inauguration, assuming we have one, in January. And then also afterwards. So let's hope that we can manage to arrange that for her. And also, of course, thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, the comment page, and our email addresses if you want to email us. So you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can't afford it, if you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub via thisweekoneword.org.uk. It's all there, plus the longer interviews, of course. And we've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. It's the last week, I think, pretty much, isn't it now? If you wanted to order one of my books for Christmas, which is include, by the way, Bible studies on that eBay platform. If you follow the links in bilderberg.org, you'll find my little eBay shop. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us on FM, AM, longwave or shortwave, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5, the last one before the Christmas break. And don't let the synagogue of Satan get you down.
It's no secret at all when you got